Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. We will get our committee meeting started. We have a full agenda, and in order to get through at a reasonable amount of time this afternoon, we need to go ahead and get started. So please take your seats. And I would ask that those of you who have cell phones and other wireless devices, please check to see that your ringer is on silent or vibrate so that there'll be no disruptions from those devices. This is the joint HHS Oversight Committee meeting for the 11th of December, and we are welcome to all of you who are here today. I'd like to introduce our sergeants at arms from the House, Bill Bass and Wayne Davis, from the Senate, Anderson Meadows and Billy Fritcher, and we're glad to have these gentlemen with us today. If you need any assistance, please let them know. As far as the agenda is concerned today, we're going to group the first three presenters together to form a panel and let them give their information to us in order, and then we'll have a short panel discussion after that in which they will be able to take any questions for you at that time. So we will get right into it. I think they have moved up to the table already, and we'll proceed in just a moment, please. I'd like Chairman Dollar to make a comment at this time.
Thank you, Chairman Pate. I just want to preface the two panels that are going to be presenting to us this morning. One of the things the chairs had been discussing for some time is the opportunity to sort of step back from the forest, or step back from the trees, rather, and see the forest. We do a lot of work on the trees in this committee, sometimes chopping at them, but one of the things that I think that we are cognizant of is that what we would like to do in this state is to develop a broader vision, a set of goals for what we want the healthcare system to look like in the state of North Carolina. And so I certainly join with Chairman Pate, Chairman Burr, in welcoming our panelists here today who will help give us what I think we believe is some much-needed perspective on the state of our healthcare system and a number of the major issues that are going to be facing us, and probably even some of the goals that we may want to aspire to as a state as we seek to have an effective and efficient healthcare system that best serves the citizens and families of North Carolina. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Dollar. And our first presenter this morning will be Dr. Doris Rouse, Vice President of the Global Health Division of RTI International. She's going to speak on global health care system issues and trends. Dr. Rouse, welcome to the General Assembly. Just as an item of interest, you will have to hold the microphone down while you speak.
Thank you. Chairman, committee members, staff, and others, as North Carolinians, we can be quite proud of the important contributions that the state of North Carolina has made, that its individuals and institutions have made to the improvement of world health. Justifiably, the state of North Carolina has an excellent reputation for research, innovation, product development, and service in global health. And today I'm going to speak to you about three topics. The first will be global health relevance to North Carolina, North Carolina initiatives in global health, collaborations to help us expanding the work we're doing in this area, and finish with issues and trends in this topic. But first, let's start out with a definition of global health so we're all on the same page. And this one comes from a publication from the Executive Committee of the Collaboration for Universities and Global Health. Mike Merson at Duke University is on that executive committee. But I like this definition because it's inclusive. It is defines global health as the area of study, research, and practice that places a priority on improving health and achieving equity in health for all people worldwide. I like this because it's inclusive. It doesn't talk about low-resource countries. It talks about all people worldwide, including those that might need better health equity in the U.S. and other countries. So if you're interested in this topic, I highly recommend the fall 2010 Journal of the North Carolina, issue of the North Carolina Medical Journal, which focuses on this topic of international health in North Carolina. There are a number of excellent articles here. I'm going to speak to one, which is a study that was conducted at Duke University on the economic impact of global health in the state. It was based on 2007 data, which was the most recent available at the time, addressing three different sectors in the study: nonprofit organizations, research, that's RTI International, FHI, and charities, for-profit businesses doing research and manufacturing, academia, colleges and universities across the state. And the study looked at jobs and economic benefits in the area of global health. And in this case, it focused on global health activities focused on low and low to middle income countries as defined by the World Bank. And here's a summary of that study. You can see the sectors are on the left. The nonprofit sector, again, FHI, RTI, IPAS, IntraHealth, other organizations like that. In 2007, there were 3,400 jobs in the state of North Carolina dedicated to global health in those organizations, with $267 million in wages and $1 billion in total economic impact to the state. The next sector was the business sector, pharmaceuticals and medical device supplies, manufacturing, with 3,000 jobs in the state dedicated to global health in low and low to middle income countries, $220 million in wages and almost $600 million in total economic impact. And finally, the universities across the state, UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, Wake Forest, and others, 581 jobs, $21 million in wages, and $51 million in total impact. These numbers have grown since 2007. For example, at Duke, the Global Health Institute was just starting in 2007. They've quadrupled their revenue since that time period. One thing that jumped out at me in this study was that 19.5% of all North Carolina exports are to low and low to middle income countries. And by comparison, only 24.4% of our exports are to Canada. So it's an important economic consideration for the state of North Carolina. Those countries are primarily South Africa, Brazil, Russia, Turkey, and Mexico. So to summarize, across all of the sectors, the total impact for global health work is 7,000 jobs in the year 2007, $508 million in wages, and nearly $2 billion in total impact on the economy. So that's the economic impact on the state of North Carolina. And what's the state of North Carolina's impact on global health as a result of the work done in those jobs? Well, it substantially improved health conditions for underserved populations worldwide. And medical innovations, I'll speak to some of those as we go through, to advance health care for all. And that when saying health care for all, I include North Carolina. A number of the innovations, as you'll see when I go through it, are benefiting the state of North Carolina's health as well. So now I'd like to talk about a collaboration within North Carolina to expand our work in global health, to improve it through collaboration across the sectors and organizations in the state. And this initiative that I'm speaking to is called the Triangle Global Health Consortium. It was started in 2009 by the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, as well as RTI, FHI, IntraHealth, and UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, and NC State. And it was established to look at how the synergies can be realized across organizations, that all of these organizations realize that we could accomplish so much more if we all work together than each of us could accomplish working individually. And there is a website here for the Triangle Global Health Consortium. Its primary goals were to brand North Carolina as a global health leader. Now, as I said earlier, North Carolina already has an excellent reputation in this area. This is really to kind of turn up the volume so that when people had a problem in global health, they would think about coming to the state of North Carolina for a solution. It's also established to serve the global and local health community in North Carolina, to bring together a way to access the expertise in one place rather than go individually to a lot of organizations, and to advance multidisciplinary and multisectoral public and private communication and information sharing and workforce development. One of the most exciting things that has come out of this is it serves as a clearinghouse for students in the colleges and universities in North Carolina that are interested in global health and would like to do an internship. This is a clearinghouse where they can find internships with the RTIs or with the for-profit companies in the state, and that's been an exciting development as a result. This shows the members of the Triangle Global Health Consortium now, which I believe we can safely say it's outgrown its name, and perhaps we should rename it as the North Carolina Global Health Consortium. There are a number of organizations outside of the Triangle. UNCG is a good example. So it's a very good example of the state of North Carolina taking the initiative to collaborate and have a greater impact in global health through collaborative efforts. So now let's turn to some of the trends that we're seeing in global health, not just in North Carolina, but in all of the organizations worldwide working in global health. And I'll start out by looking at what conditions are being targeted in global health. First, infectious diseases. For the last 15 and 20 years or more, the primary focus has been on HIV/AIDS, TB, and malaria, the three primary infectious diseases, appropriately. And North Carolina has had an impact on that. HIV/AIDS, the Burroughs Wellcome, which was the predecessor to GSK, and by full disclosure, it was my first job after coming out of Peace Corps, was at Burroughs Wellcome. It's a great organization. But Burroughs Wellcome played a major role in the development of AZT, which was the first therapeutic for treating HIV/AIDS. In TB, there hasn't been a new drug for tuberculosis in more than 60 years. More than 60 years. And we're seeing now around the world, because there hasn't been a new drug, we're seeing drug-resistant TB and multi-drug-resistant TB. It's treated with four different drugs. Multi-drug-resistant is the case where someone is resistant to two of those drugs, and so they must undergo a much more toxic and long-term expensive therapy. We've been involved in establishing in 2000 a public-private partnership called the Global Alliance for TB Drug Development to develop new drugs for TB. It's based in New York. RTI was involved in establishing it, and we've been involved in moving new drugs through the system. And I'm happy to say there are two late-stage drugs that are in late-stage clinical trials, both of which have shown activity against these drug-resistant strains of TB. Now, North Carolina doesn't have much in the way of TB. They've done a superb job of instituting a public health system to control it. But there were 13 cases of drug-resistant TB in the state last year, and it's a very contagious disease. So it's the state's done a very good job of pulling together its public health system. We need to look at innovations across the public health sectors. Other infectious diseases, diarrheal disease and hepatitis, are areas of interest on a global health perspective. There's a great interest in developing and providing universal access to vaccines. We've seen with polio and with smallpox that we can eradicate diseases with effective vaccines and universal coverage. It's not an easy thing to do, accomplishing universal coverage, but we can eliminate those diseases. An emphasis now is on rotavirus, which is responsible for diarrheal diseases, which are the greatest killer of children under five, and pneumococcal vaccine. So there's an emphasis in making widespread these new vaccines. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is very active in funding the development and the distribution of those. HPV vaccine can prevent cervical cancer in young women. Again, we need to get broad distribution of that, not just in low-resource countries, but in North Carolina and other U.S. states as well. Non-communicable diseases. By definition, these are diseases that are not spread from one person to another. They're not infectious diseases. The UN had a major summit 2 years ago addressing the issue of non-communicable diseases. four primary non-communicable diseases: cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular, and respiratory, not infectious respiratory, but non-infectious respiratory disease. Those four are responsible for more than 60% of the deaths worldwide. So the UN held this summit and said we need to pay more attention to these NCDs across the world. And to show the area, National Cancer Institute, the largest of the National Institutes of Health, established a Center for Global Health this past year, recognizing the importance of NCDs. So we're seeing an increased attention being paid to those diseases. Maternal, newborn, and child health is an area that's gotten increased funding and attention from both government and foundations, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and there's quite a bit of work going on in the state of North Carolina. We work with UNC on an evidence-based practice center. We're funded by the Gates Foundation to develop a decision support tool to help them determine which technologies they should develop based on how effective those technologies are in reducing maternal and newborn mortality. And then finally, water and sanitation is a key element to global health, and North Carolina has done quite a bit of work in that. UNC has a water institute, and a good example, and NC State's done considerable work in this area. A good example is a ceramic water purifier developed by UNC that's simple, inexpensive, can be made in-country, and has helped to provide safe drinking water for quite a broad population. So now let's look at the trends in global health, the approaches that are taken to solve these problems, as we've just mentioned. And over the last decade, the major trend has been capacity building in countries. And the best way to describe this is that they're teaching communities and countries how to fish, not providing the fish for dinner every evening. And it's been very successful. There have been successful university partnerships for both clinical practice, improving clinical practice and research capabilities. Duke and UNC have partnerships with clinical centers in Tanzania, Malawi, Kenya, and other in Zambia, as well as China and other places. It's been very effective in enabling them to learn from the expertise of the universities here in North Carolina. Then the government and others are providing facilities and equipment to low-resource countries, but they're also providing training and empowering the communities to do their own management and maintenance of that equipment. These are sustainable solutions. They're building organizational supports and developing a handover plan. You may teach a biomedical engineer in a country how to repair the equipment in their operating room, but you also develop a plan for their being able to consult back to you when you're back in the U.S. after you've trained them if they run into a problem. So it's a handover plan that isn't just, I've taught you, goodbye, good luck. If you go to many of these places, you'll see equipment in the back of the facility that's just been, can't be repaired, and there's no one there that can do it, so that donation is going unused. There's also quite a bit being done in undergraduate student training in country. Both universities in the state of North Carolina are placing students in research at those universities in which they're working in country so that we can build the next generation of leaders in global health. And finally, there's a trend to move from bench to bedside. That is, not just doing research and thinking that's enough. We need to make sure that that research is turned into a product and made available to those who can benefit from it. And that's a special emphasis by the National Institutes of Health now in terms of translational research. Finally, the approaches in global health include multilateral collaborations. The UN, for example, has started an innovation working group on maternal and child health, and we're a member of that. It's chaired by the government of Norway and Johnson & Johnson. So, again, we're going back to the public and private collaborations. WHO has established a framework convention on tobacco control. 168 countries have signed that framework convention to look at controlling tobacco and the harmful health effects it can have. A major emphasis now was on public-private partnerships over the past decade. As I mentioned, we were involved in establishing the successful Global Alliance for TB Drug Development. There's one for Medicines for Malaria Venture, and there's one for developing and making sure there's wide distribution of vaccines called Gavi. We helped to form another one in TB called PANACEA, which is a long acronym, probably breaks every rule for acronyms, but it's a good name, so we like it. It's a Pan-African Consortium for the Evaluation of Anti-Tuberculosis Antimicrobials, in which we brought together European universities, a number of sub-Saharan African sites, I think 11 of those, and three drug manufacturers. That partnership wrote a proposal to the European community for 27 million euros, or about $50 million, and it's been funded. The exciting part about this, it was funded to conduct clinical trials of the drugs for those companies. But also included in that was developing clinical trial capacity development in those clinical trial sites in Africa, so that we'll have that capacity there as we develop new drugs for tuberculosis. We can't do clinical trials on TB in North Carolina. There aren't, thankfully, aren't enough TB patients. So we have to go to sites in Africa and other countries that have a larger population with TB. And finally, the other trend that we're seeing is increased business involvement, substantially increased business involvement over the last 10 to 12 years. Part of that is corporate social responsibility. Companies feel a responsibility to take care of the wealth, the health of their employees, as well as the community in which they're based in these low-resource countries. But we're also seeing companies recognize expanded markets. You saw the impact on the economy and the exports in North Carolina. So companies are seeing the Russias and the Chinas and Mexico and Brazils as and India as expanding their markets for their particular drugs. So I'd like to close with a discussion on North Carolina's impact from research to implementation. And this is that moving from bench to bedside, not just developing the research, but seeing that it's made into a product and made widely available to individuals. And North Carolina is well positioned to do this, because in order to make this happen, you have to have a strong basic and applied research base. Certainly North Carolina has that in spades. You also need product development and commercialization capability. We have a strong industry and not-for-profit capability in doing exactly that. And then implementation and scale-up in country with both industry and the IPASs, RTIs, IntraHealth, we do that as well. So North Carolina is especially well-positioned because it has the capability, organizations, and commitment to make important contributions across the spectrum of global health needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Rouse. That was very important, and I think something that we needed to hear. Thank you for that, and would you remain until after the panel has finished, and then if there are any questions that come your way, we will field them at that time. Next, the next speaker, and I don't know if this mic. The next speaker will be speaking on the national healthcare system issues and trends, and that's Dr. William Roper, who probably needs no introduction to most of the members in this room. He's the chief executive officer of the University of North Carolina healthcare system, and I won't read off all the other kudos that go with that. But Dr. Roper, we're certainly honored to have you here today, and please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Pate. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to be invited to chat with you today and to be on this panel with distinguished colleagues. I welcome the chance to talk with you about national trends in healthcare. I'll not be, except in follow-up questions for illustration, talking about UNC's efforts in this regard, but rather trying to give you, as you said in your setup piece, a picture for what the forest looks like, and then later perhaps we can talk about some trees. I've had the chance to talk to Mr. Dollar earlier about this, and I welcome the chance to visit with you all at some greater length. If I could just add a personal further introduction, as some of you may know, I served in Washington for a number of years and was political appointee for three Republican presidents, Ronald Reagan and the two George Bushes. I served as head of the federal agency that runs Medicare and Medicaid, currently called CMS, and as head of the Centers for Disease Control, the public health agency in Atlanta. I say those things to say much too much of our time these days in health and healthcare is spent in partisan wrangling, and my central appeal in all of this is these are issues that deserve our careful attention, whether one is a registered Republican, as I am, or a registered Democrat, as many of you are, or independent, or whatever. I trust you take the point that I'm trying to make. These are extremely complex issues, and it is worthy, I believe, to do what Mr. Dollar asked, and that is that we try to see the forest before we get to the trees. And in that regard, what I'm going to try to do is set up my talk, and I don't have slides, so this is going to be a conversation. I set up my talk by suggesting what I think are five commonly expressed core ideas about health care in America that are just not true. These are things that people, many people at least, confidently believe are real, but they are myths. The first of them is that the American healthcare system is the best in the world. I trust you've heard that, maybe heard it often. It is undeniably true that in America we have the benefit of many breakthroughs in medicine that are better than any other place in the world. But the problem with trying to say we have the best health system in the world is, on average, the results of the care given in the American health system is much worse than is the case with many other countries. And I know many of us hate international comparisons, but just if you look at things like longevity and common measures of outcomes of care, on average, we do worse than in many other countries. And the problem with that is it's an average comparison. Yes, many of us have access to the best of American health care, and we do better than anybody else in the world. But our average is pulled down by the fact that many people who live in America don't have access to those things. I frankly believe that the assertion that we have the best health care system in the world today is really a way of people saying, let's just leave things the way they are. Let's not monkey with it. Let's not change things. And unfortunately, as you'll see from what I shortly say, I think we need to change a lot of things about health care in America today. A second myth that I believe people confidently hold is that at the end of the day, everybody actually gets all the care that they need. That's often expressed as people are discussing or debating ways of providing care to people who are uninsured or in other ways fall through the cracks of our health system. And I believe it's an effort to reassure ourselves that we shouldn't worry about those things. Unfortunately, that's a myth. Everybody does not get all the care that they need. Repeated studies have shown conclusively that there's a huge cost to American society to the uninsured. That is, people seek care later and they have worse illnesses and worse outcomes. It leads to the crazy quilt of cross subsidies as we attempt to provide care for people who are uninsured or otherwise without means to pay for their care. We are much worse off because of the fact that not everybody gets the care that they need. Third myth, almost always the quality of care people get in America is very good. I wish I could tell you that's the case, but unfortunately it's not. Repeated studies by nationally renowned health services researchers and others have shown that even in the best of hospitals, the best of institutions, people don't get the care that they need and that we as healthcare providers know that they need to get. The Institute of Medicine in Washington and others have shown the harm done because of the lack of patient safety, even in the best of institutions. I chair the board of an organization called the National Quality Forum. It's all about trying to measure and report results on healthcare quality and improve quality, and it is repeatedly shown that we could do much better, and that's why many organizations have banded together to say we need to push ourselves to improve healthcare quality and patient safety in America. The fourth myth, the cost of care in America is really not a problem. Now, maybe you've never heard somebody say this, but if you hear people talk about how healthcare employment is what's pulling the rest of the economy along, and it is, the healthcare unemployment rate in North Carolina is 2%. It's an industry that employs lots of people. For the most part, we don't pollute. And so perhaps the unstated point is, what's the worry? Why don't we just accept the fact that people value healthcare highly and tolerate the fact that we now devote 17% of our national economy to healthcare? The problem is, unfortunately, we are in a globally competitive economy, and we are carrying a great burden by the fact that it costs so much more to provide for the healthcare needs of our fellow citizens than it does in other nations. And so I would say, broadly speaking, proposals for healthcare overhaul or reform that don't take cost control seriously shouldn't be taken seriously themselves. But we need to acknowledge, and I readily do this as CEO of a large healthcare organization, that controlling costs is going to be difficult, and it's going to be uncomfortable for those of us who live and work in healthcare, unquestionably. I believe we are now headed into a multi-year period when the great issue in healthcare will be the great downward pressure on the cost of healthcare. And I promise you, this is going to be difficult and challenging for those of us who live and work in healthcare, those of you who are elected officials, indeed for all in American society. And then finally, my fifth myth about healthcare in America is, if you like your care the way it is, nothing about it will change, or nothing about it will need to change. Unfortunately, I believe in some respects that's the most problematic of these myths. And you've probably heard it from lots of people, including our president, when he arguing for what has come even to him to be known as Obamacare, when he was arguing for changes in health care, he said, if you like your health care the way it is, nothing about it will change. We're only talking about what's going to be done for other people. The difficulty with that is, as I've tried to set up in these other points, we need to change lots of things about how healthcare is organized and financed and delivered if we're going to have the ability to create the healthcare system that I'm here calling for. For example, we need to redesign care in fundamental ways to create coordinated care across primary and specialty doctors and others, so that each person has what some have called a patient-centered medical home. And happily, many leaders in many organizations right here in North Carolina are working to do just that, to create the healthcare system for the future that will do the things that we're here talking about. One of the outcomes, let me just step back from the myths and make a couple of more points. One of the outcomes of all of these pressures for change that I'm here talking about is the fact that healthcare in America is consolidating. Doctors and hospitals are freely choosing to join into larger organizations to do the difficult things that we're here talking about, to modernize their systems and to deliver the care that patients need and you all value. That consolidation is, again, uncomfortable for us all. And you may like the fact that healthcare in North Carolina is consolidating, or you may hate it and think it's a terrible idea. My simple point, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, is it doesn't matter what you think about that. It is happening. And so for organizations like mine, the question is, will we take ourselves out of that game while healthcare is organized around us, or will we be participants in it? And I believe you know our answer is we need to be participants and try to shape our destiny in a way that achieves the right kinds of outcomes. These are big-time issues. I wish I could believe that simply my calling for bipartisan cooperation will lead to it. But nonetheless, that's what we need right now. And I trust that you will rise to the occasion. I'd be happy to enter into the conversation later on. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Roper. I'm sure that members will want to interact with you as we go forward with this panel discussion. Next, we have Dr. Pam Silberman, who is going to speak on state health care system issues and trends. She is the president and CEO of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine. Please go ahead, Dr. Silberman.
Thank you for inviting me to be here today. I also greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all and to be on this panel today with my esteemed colleagues. I want to just start by telling you a little bit about the North Carolina Institute of Medicine, and then I will go into my presentation. For those of you who are not familiar with us, we were created by the North Carolina General Assembly in 1983, and we were established to study health problems facing the state. So we study health problems at the request of the General Assembly or the executive branch or sometimes our board or other community groups. So let me talk about where I am going to focus my presentation. I was asked to talk more generally about healthcare trends and healthcare issues facing the state, not specifically about healthcare reform. So I am not going to be spending my time talking about healthcare reform today, but more generally, what are the issues that affect health in North Carolina? And I'm going to start with a snapshot, and it's sort of interesting that I'm giving this presentation today. Dr. Roper actually helped create this snapshot. It's called America's Health Rankings. And every year they look at health status of the different states in the country and look at it in a host of different measures and then give us a sort of overall grade. And the reason it's sort of interesting to do it today is because this afternoon the more recent rankings will come out. So these are last year's rankings. Today we'll know what the more recent rankings are. But in 2011, we were ranked 32nd of the 50 states when you look at the composite of about, I think it was 24 different health rankings. If you take a look at the determinants of health, such as smoking, drinking, obesity, poverty, we were 31st. If you take a look at certain health outcome measures, we were 38th. And I'm starting with that, and I'm going to circle back to that because everything that I want to talk about is really focusing on if we want to improve health status, what do we need to do in this state? There's good news and there's bad news in my presentation. And so you're going to see a little bit of both as I go through the presentation. Let's start with a little bit of the good news. If you take a look at life expectancy, it's not huge increases, but this is only over a four-year time period. You can see that over the last 4 years, our life expectancy has grown from about 77.5 years in 2008 to 78.2 years in 2011. So then I wanted to take a look at what are the leading causes of death in North Carolina. And if you take a look at this slide, it's a little bit confusing, so let me walk you through it. What I've given you here are two numbers for each of these different causes of death. The number in parentheses are the actual number of deaths in 2011. How many people died, for example, due to cancer? There were over 18,000 people who died due to cancer. But another number that we like to look at with in terms of public health is not only what are the leading causes of death, but what are the leading causes of premature death? Those deaths that occur before age 75, thinking that about 75 is the average age. And when you look at that, cancer is still the largest cause of premature death, but certain things like suicide increase because that tends to happen with younger adults or with children. So there's more years of potential life lost for somebody who commits suicide at the age of 22 than somebody who dies of cancer at the age of 74. So what are the underlying determinants of health? I broke it into four segments here. You can see genes and biology. Our genetic makeup contributes to our health outcomes. Whether we get health services affects our health outcomes and the quality of the care that we get. Whether we are sort of community and environment factors, and then health behaviors. And I will be talking about three out of those four because at this point, we still don't have a whole lot of ways in which we can affect the genetic makeup. So let's start with cost, access, and quality, which is sort of the health services side. As you heard from Dr. Roper, we are spending more in health care than, well, what he didn't say is that we're spending more in health care than any other country in the world. No matter how you look at it, we spend more in health care if you consider it as a percentage of our gross domestic product or if you consider it in terms of normalized dollars. What we know is that health care costs are rising on average about 3 times the rate of general inflation. So I went back and took a look at some North Carolina-specific data, and these are premium costs that employers pay. And if you look at the between 1998 and 2011, premiums on average for a single employee increased over 160%. During that same time period, overall inflation was 38%. When you have rising health care costs, that contributes to the ability of people to buy health insurance coverage. The number one reason that people quote for saying that they're uninsured is because they can't afford the cost of premiums. So what you see in North Carolina, and this again builds on what Dr. Roper said, is that in North Carolina, close to 20% of the non-elderly in our state lack health insurance coverage. The most recent data is that about 1.5 million people lacked health insurance coverage. And there is over 30 years of good, solid research that shows that when people lack health insurance coverage, they're less likely to go in for preventive screenings, they're less likely to go in for primary care, they're less likely to manage their chronic illness, they're more likely to end up in the hospital with late-stage diagnosed cancer, and they're more likely to die prematurely. So this is just, again, some North Carolina data that shows, these are our survey data of North Carolinians that show that the uninsured are more likely to report being in poor or fair health, and they're also more likely to report access barriers or lacking a primary care provider. Now let me move to quality, which was the third part of the healthcare system factors, again building on what Dr. Roper was saying. The U.S. Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality creates a dashboard. It's sort of a comparison of one state to the other. It's built a lot on the quality indicators that Dr. Roper was talking about before out of the National Quality Forum. They look at more than 150 different measures. And when you look at North Carolina, we rank average compared to other states. So when you look at different settings of care, you can see in the middle column, this is the most recent data that shows how many measures were better on, how many measures were worse on, how many measures were comparable to the national average. I'd rather you look at the right-hand column, which is the trends over time, because that's the good news. The good news is that with all the focus that we've had on quality, a lot due to the work that Dr. Roper has done with the National Quality Forum, we have made some real progress in many areas in improving quality. And so if you can see on this, on the right-hand side, hospital measures in North Carolina over with their trend data, they have different baseline years and then different, and then they measure it compared to the current year, we are improving on 81% of the measures. In ambulatory care, 44% of the measures. Nursing home care, 79% of the measures. We aren't doing as well in home health. So if you take a look on, I'm now moving to community and environment. If you take a look at community and environment, I just wanted to pull out a couple of factors that we know are directly linked to health status. So if you look at education, there's a lot of research that show that people who have lower educational achievements have worse health status than people who have more education. A lot of that is due to the income that they earn, their ability to get health care, where they live, what they eat. But we know that there are different health risks associated with people who have lower educational attainment. Now, here's good news. The good news is because of a lot of the focus that you all have put on education over the last 10 years, we have started to see improvements, significant improvements in our high school graduation rates. This is a four-year cohort, so what they're looking at is the students who start 1 year, 4 years from then, what percentage of them are graduating, and we have seen significant improvement there. However, As I said, this is good news, bad news. On childhood poverty, we're not doing as well. And we know that poverty is linked to health status. People who have lower incomes are less likely to have good health than people who have higher incomes. And we know that the experiences that people have as children will affect their well-being later on in adulthood. And this is an area that we're not doing as well. If you look at trend data, we are seeing an increase in our child poverty rate. Finally, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about community factors and the built environment. People who have access to sidewalks, access to parks, are more likely to get out and exercise if there's a safe place where they can exercise. If there's a place where they can buy fruits and vegetables, they're more likely to buy fruits and vegetables. So the environment in which you live, the community in which you live, affects your health status as well. And on the good news there, there has been a lot of work over the last couple of years to try to develop more access to sidewalks, to bicycle lanes, to healthy food establishments. So there's been some improvement there. Finally, I want to circle back to the sort of health status indicators, and I'm going to focus in on health behaviors. I've picked two. Obesity is really a composite of nutrition and exercise, and I'm also going to look at the tobacco use as well. And as I've said before, good news and bad news on this front. So I'm going to start here with the bad news. What we know from a lot of research is that obesity, which you know, this is not saying anything that anyone doesn't know. Obesity is related to how much we eat and how much we exercise. It's pretty simple. How many calories we take in and how many calories we burn up. Obesity is related and it contributes to heart disease, type 2 diabetes, stroke, and certain types of cancer. And there's some estimates that the medical cost for people who are obese was estimated to be about 42% higher than spending for somebody who is not obese. So if you take a look at trend data here, we're not doing so well. We have higher obesity rates than the national average, but everybody is not doing well. Obesity rates are going up for everybody, although there was something in today's newspaper about how childhood obesity has gone down, I think, this last year, just by inch down a little bit, yes. So that's the bad news, but the reason I point that out first is because we do know what to do to address some of these things. So let me go to tobacco. If I had been giving you this presentation 10 years ago, I would have shown you a slide very similar to that. Our tobacco rates were going up dramatically 10 years ago. We know that tobacco causes more deaths than HIV, drug use, alcohol use combined. Cigarette smoking contributes to a whole lot of health problems, including cardiovascular disease, emphysema, bronchitis, and many other conditions, including many cancers. And there are some economic consequences to smoking. But what we know is that if you want to address these kinds of health behavior problems, that you really need to take a multifaceted approach to address it. There is no one magic bullet where you can say, if you just do this, all of our problems will go away. What works is addressing the problem at multiple levels, having social marketing campaigns, having doctors give advice to patients around quitting smoking, having schools that no longer allow smoking in the school. So let me just start out with 10 years ago, 1999, this was in the News and Observer, and it said, a new CDC report says 35.8% of teens are using cigarettes, and it basically says that the rate had increased over the last, the trend was going up over the last 6 years. So in 1999, we were seeing an increased use of tobacco among youth. What did we do in North Carolina? Starting in 1999, almost 32% of youth were smoking in North Carolina, reported that they were current cigarette smokers. So we started, and many of you may remember that, with voluntary efforts to make schools 100% smoke-free. Started in 1999, it was voluntary. Eventually in 2008, it became mandatory. Then we had the Tobacco Master Settlement Fund, which was basically the funds that came out of the lawsuit that went to a number of different funds. Part of it went to Health and Wellness Trust Fund. They helped fund, and many of you may remember seeing on TV, the True campaign, the young woman who had a voice box because she had lost her larynx because of cancer. So that there was a bunch of social marketing efforts that went out to try to get people to reduce their smoking. Then we had the increase that you all put into the General Assembly put in into the cigarette tax, which further reduced smoking. We know from a lot of research that tobacco taxes reduce smoking, and it particularly reduces smoking around youth. Then there was the federal tobacco tax, and each time you can see a continued reduction in smoking. We do know what makes a difference in trying to address health behaviors. In fact, last year, the North Carolina Institute of Medicine worked with the Division of Public Health in order to produce our Healthy North Carolina 2020 goals and objectives. In the first year after we identified 40 different objectives, there was improvement in almost 60% of those objectives. So we do know what can make a difference, but it takes concerted effort in order to do it. So in summary, if we want to improve North Carolina's health status so we're not in the bottom third of most health measures, we really need to address all three aspects of that pie chart. We need to improve access to affordable and high-quality health services. We need to rein in rising health care costs, as Dr. Roper mentioned. We need to improve community and environmental factors that underlie health, and we need to help people reduce their risky health behaviors. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Silberman. We appreciate your input there, and at this time we'll bring up the lights and we will entertain questions from members of the committee for either of these three presenters. I'd like to start off with asking Dr. Rouse to comment briefly on polio eradication, the worldwide effort to do that.
Yeah, thank you. I certainly remember the introduction of the polio vaccine in the early 50s. And in the U.S., we eradicated polio pretty effectively in the ensuing decade or two after that. But the rest of the world did not have access to the polio vaccine. So the world really took the efforts to realize universal access and implement that. And now it's, for the most part, eradicated around the world. So it's really providing that universal access in order to eradicate that disease.
I'm in a civic club that was instrumental in getting that started, the Rotary International, and there's still some pockets out there that are still very troublesome, and I would love to see the day come when it actually is eradicated.
That's true, and Rotary has done a superb job of addressing those difficult-to-reach pockets.
Chairman Dollar.
Thank you, Chairman Pate. I'll start out with maybe a couple of questions, and then I know that a lot of people want to ask questions, so maybe I'll come back later. Dr. Rouse, I wanted to follow up on something that you may have some ideas about or may want to get back to us with some ideas about. In your next to the last slide, you talked about moving technology from the bench to the bedside. You talked about really economic development and job growth in North Carolina from the medical, biomedical, the healthcare field in products, services, and the like that we can develop. You talked about how well-positioned North Carolina already is, and that is certainly a growing sector. And given that North Carolina is in a major has been in a major transition in its economy, I guess maybe my question is what more can we do, or what are some potential steps that the state of North Carolina could take to continue to assist in the growth of this industry in North Carolina, which would obviously, you know, it produces higher level jobs, and as Dr. Roper said, it's mostly non-polluting, but has tremendous economic potential for even greater economic benefit to our citizens.
Good question. The university system, the research base here, is certainly a magnet for industry, and we've seen that over the years. I think, and I'd like to go into more detail to think about this and get back to you, but my initial response is that we need to get more forums for collaboration between the universities and the biotechnology, pharmaceutical, major pharmaceutical companies. We're seeing that. We're seeing some collaborations and proposals to the National Institutes of Health. We're working with UNC on the Center for Translational Technologies. So if we can provide more forums for that interaction, for an understanding of the research in the universities and the interests of the biotech centers, I think we'll see that growth and that when those collaborations are made known to the rest of the industry, we'll see even more attraction to the state of North Carolina.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, let me go ahead and ask one other question, and then I'll pass for some other folks to ask questions. But this one is for Dr. Roper. Dr. Roper, you laid out a number of trends and myths and the like in terms of healthcare. We, of course, are trying to get a handle on costs with respect to Medicaid, and of course, those costs in Medicaid are tied to the cost of the overall healthcare system. We're just part of it, and but thinking about Medicaid in particular, some of the ideas that have been put forward recently, and some of the other states out there have been looking at various waiver environments. For example, a number of states have looked at 1115 waiver. Some states, I think Texas, Oregon, and some others, have been in the process or are in the process of implementing a broader use of the 1115 waiver. Would you have any particular thoughts on what you know about that? But that waiver, given where you have been in the federal government and CMS, maybe a little some considerations that we want to. Might want to take into account, good, bad, or indifferent, about exploring that type of waiver environment here in North Carolina.
Thank you, sir. Yes, I'd be happy to respond. The major problem we have with healthcare costs is we have a system that rewards volume of services instead of rewarding value in health services. So we pay for volume instead of paying for value, broadly speaking. The more you do, the more you get paid, instead of the better outcomes, the more you get paid. You ask about waivers as a tool to improve the Medicaid program. Yes, I strongly believe the state needs to pursue those opportunities for greater flexibility. Years ago in the Reagan and then George Herbert Walker Bush administration, I chaired a thing in the federal government called the Low Income Opportunity Board that gave recommendations to the president on which waivers to approve. So there were waivers not only for Medicaid, but Medicare and the various HUD programs and food stamps and all of the low-income serving programs. And so an outgrowth of that experience is I strongly believe that states need to look to their individual circumstance and take full advantage of the federal waiver program and tailor the program to meet their needs. If I can just make one additional point, mixing some politics into this, I strongly believe that with 33 Republican governors and a federal administration controlled by a Democratic president, that there's an opportunity here for incoming Governor McCrory and you, the leaders of the legislature, to say, we want to manage our program and to do that in concert with other Republican governors around the country to say, give us greater flexibility for Medicaid management and we will work with you on these broad issues that we face together. The Medicaid program does an awful lot of good, but it needs badly to be improved, and I think the waiver programs that are available are an important means to that end.
Thank you.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Dr. Rouse, but first I want to say it's rather ironic that you mentioned the polio epidemic, because tomorrow I have a program at Rotary about living with polio where I have three classmates who are going to give true stories tomorrow. And even though we haven't eradicated it, there is no cure. And they're still living with it here, and we do have programs that we have in our health system that are helping some of those, the CAP program and others. But some are living independently and having really bad problems and can't get help. So it's very important. We haven't had one in the United States since 1979, so I've done a lot of research on that particular thing right now. But my question is, we're having so many parents who are very concerned about inoculations and don't want their children to have inoculations, and especially with autism. They think it's causing autism. And you were talking about TB and drug resistance. I just wondered if there was any work being done on that as far as helping the parents to understand that they really need to inoculate their children, such as polio that we had back then.
Thank you. That's a very good question, and it's not really the field that I'm terribly involved in. Others on the panel may be able to address this, but certainly there needs to be there's terrific work going on in evidence-based practice centers to look at what is really the evidence, the research basis that tells you, in fact, are there negative consequences of the immunization? How does that compare with the positives of an immunization? And then there needs to be, as there was with tobacco, social media to inform parents. They need a way to easily find out what the benefits and, if there are risks, what those are for their children. So evidence-based practice and then an effective communication system is the way forward with that. Thank you.
Further questions from members of the committee? Yes, Senator, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is probably for Dr. Roper or Ms. Silverman, but you mentioned restructuring the sort of the payment structure on an outcomes basis. That sounds great. Do you have any suggestions on how in the heaven's name we do it? And I'd be interested in that.
There's already some movement in the Affordable Care Act to do it on the Medicare side. Dr. Roper is sort of struggling. I don't want to say struggling, but hospitals in North Carolina are trying to address it right now. The two things that have gone into effect already with hospitals on Medicare is, one is they get reduced payments from the federal government if they have excess hospital readmissions, and it's for three conditions around pneumonia, heart failure, and heart attacks. And number two, they get what's called value-based payments. So every hospital puts in a 1% into the federal government, and then they get back a certain amount depending on how well they perform on five different measures, including measures or five different areas, including measures around pneumonia, treatment of pneumonia, heart attacks, heart failure, and then hospital-acquired conditions, and I can't remember the fifth one. So those are models that are being tested right now. The Affordable Care Act does require Congress to look at doing similar things with nursing homes, with other industries, and eventually with physicians, although physicians are later on down the road. So there are some ideas already being implemented, and we'll be able to get a sense of seeing on the Medicare side if that is leading to improved value.
May I just add a couple of points?
Please.
Senator, the major way we pay for health care in America is the fee-for-service system, where I, as a pediatrician, get paid more if I see more patients, do more services, whatever, and hospitals are generally paid the same way. As Dr. Silberman describes, there now is built principally into the Medicare program a series of extra bonus payments, if you will, for doing extra things or getting very good outcomes. Ultimately, I think where we need to head is to pay for health care for providing all the care that a person or a family or a group of patients or thousands of people need over a period of time. And what that does, that notion that I've just tried to describe there is generally known as capitation. What that does is change the incentives to me as a doctor or a hospital administrator to say it's in my interest to keep you healthy, to treat you in the most cost-effective way, and to make sure that you get all the follow-up care that you need instead of having you get terribly ill and need high-cost intensive care treatment, et cetera. Now, that is a notion that is complicated, but it is being done. Lots of businesses are in paying for their health workforce are interested in heading that direction. Let me just add a point, if I could, and then I'll stop. There are some states who have experimented with doing capitation for their Medicaid programs, going all the way to that end. I'm a great believer in capitation, as I have said just a moment ago. But I would urge you, please, those of you that are custodians of the Medicaid program, to be somewhat skeptical about people coming to you saying, give us the Medicaid program, we'll promise you hundreds of millions of dollars in savings, and we'll take care of it. That kind of sweeping promises has caused this state a world of trouble in the mental health system, and I just would be skeptical when people come shopping those wares. Not everything, every claim that's made is actually true.
Senator Hartzell, just a follow-up question.
Follow-up. But it also involves, to some extent, individuals taking some greater responsibility for their own health care.
Of course it does.
And how do you, what's the best way, I mean, do you have any suggestions on how we essentially encourage that?
Sure.
In combination?
Most of us respond to financial incentives. And so one of the things that I have long advocated is, for example, in insurance programs, to say that I will face a higher deductible or copay or greater insurance premium if I'm a smoker or if my body mass index is over a particular level or whatever. Now, there are folks, colleagues of mine, who criticize what I just have said and describe that as blaming the victim. I'm not blaming the victim, but I'm just simply trying to take advantage of one of the things that I know works, and that is people respond to financial incentives.
Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Silverman, on page 5 of your handout, you talk about the employer-sponsored premiums and the rate of increase, et cetera. You know, I employed several people in the past, and we would pay 90% of the premiums, but a lot of the employees wouldn't take the insurance, even if we were paying 90% of it, because you know, they were young, and so I know this is a serious problem. But as far as the employer goes, with these premiums, you know, that destroys the opportunity or initiative for an employer to even furnish insurance with these premiums. Is there any solution to this? As you, I know we have made some initiatives to try to help small employers, but it hadn't been very successful, as I understand.
So your question is there any initiative to make the premiums more affordable?
Yes, and especially with, you know, with the young, where you have some of these, as smoking and the things you've mentioned, you'd seem like, in looking back on a previous slide, you talked about binge drinking and smoking, it seemed like that would be a party state. So I was kind of surprised that it got such a negative response from that. But anyway, I'm you know, I don't mean that critically, but.
Well, let me actually put in a good word. North Carolina has a very low binge drinking rate compared to other states. That's actually one of the areas we do better than other states. Not saying that we do as well as we'd like to, but we do better on it. I think that the problem with teasing out premiums is that you can't. There's no easy answer to premiums until we start addressing overall health care costs, because premiums are really a reflection of how much we're spending on health care. So until we start addressing the kinds of things that Dr. Roper talked about and thinking about how we both incentivize people to take better care of themselves, how we provide them the tools to take better care of themselves, because it's not just penalizing, but it's also educating, providing the environment in which they can be healthier, and also starting to change the way our incentives are in our current system, it's going to be very hard to tease out the premium costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One other question. I heard Dean Roper mention the quality of care, and I was just wondering if, with that comment being made, maybe we overdid the medical malpractice that we dramatically changed, which I assumed was very helpful to the medical community. You may want to comment on that.
You did not overdo it, so thank you for the actions taken previously. The point I was straining to make, let me do it this way. We know what someone who's just had a heart attack needs to have as far as the medications that will make them better, the preventive steps that need to be taken, like counseling them to stop smoking and making sure they take an aspirin a day to prevent further or to lessen the frequency of further heart attacks. The problem is that even in hospitals like ours, it's hard to make sure that before that patient is discharged, every one of the patients gets every one of those things done to them. We've not pushed ourselves in the past to be certain of those things, and now because of the very much greater scrutiny that Pam described, we are having to do that, and that's a good thing, that we are being forced to say every patient, every day, merits the best that we can do for them, and we are, and everybody else is, getting better, as her statistics showed.
Chairman Dollar.
Thank you. Let me ask a couple of different questions. Ms. Silverman, let me ask you. You applied the model that you put forward to reducing tobacco usage in North Carolina. And, of course, some of those are actions that we took as a state. And there are also actions that were being done nationally and national trends and the like that weighed in there as well. But I guess my question is, and I'm probably not going to word this very well, but I think you can help me with it. How can we apply that model, and maybe there's a lot of folks that can help us do this, apply that model to the issue of obesity? Because I think everybody has been saying for some time now, and I think the chorus is getting louder and louder, that unless we get a handle on that chronic condition, we're going to have a hard time handling costs and outcomes and a whole host of other things, because it's one of those foundational issues that it seems to be getting worse and worse. And, of course, you know, I'm guilty of it as anybody. But how can we apply the model that we saw had success? And, of course, I'm not suggesting raising taxes, of course. So let me throw that out there. I'm not so sure that needs to be part of, but, you know, that aside, how can we apply this model to obesity and hopefully have somewhere near the same type of outcome in terms of lowering the usage and getting the health care benefit?
I think that's an excellent question, and there have been a lot of different legislative task forces that have looked at it and a lot of different national studies that have looked at it. So I'll throw out a couple of ideas, but I think that there are other people on the panel who could definitely help as well. If you take a look at clinical interventions, at least on the tobacco side, I have not seen yet on the obesity side, there's a question about whether physicians are taking body mass index, advising their patients about it, sending them to nutritionists. There is that on the tobacco side. We know that providing clinical advice to quit smoking helps. If you make that parallel, providing that kind of clinical intervention may be of assistance on the obesity side. I would argue that the place that we should be intervening the earliest is on children, because that's what's going to create the long-term health trajectory. And we've been discussing for a long time whether we have enough exercise in school, and obviously there are competing demands, but we need to think about getting really meaningful exercise and physical activity back into school, and what are we serving in our lunchrooms in schools. You can bring that down to the childcare level. Are we giving the right nutrition in childcare settings? Are we getting kids outdoors in childcare settings? Are we getting them more physically active? Are we making sure they're not sitting in front of a screen? I think we're doing a better job on the child care side than we do right now in the school system. I also think that you can think about the built environment. Are there places where people can go out and walk? Are there places where there are safe places where they can go and exercise? Where I can go in my community is very different than where a low-income person could go, where it may not be safe for them to walk outside, or if they're living next to a highway where they may not be able to have the sidewalk. So we have to think about this holistically at different aspects of it in order to address it in a multifaceted approach.
Any of the other panelists want to comment on it?
I just would add, this is a huge, no pun intended, problem, and we need to focus on it. If I could just draw the further comparison to smoking, I think if you look back over the history of our nation's public health efforts with regard to smoking, it's in about the mid-1970s, Americans decided that it was not fashionable to smoke. Now, clearly, maybe 20% of the adult population in America still do smoke, or whatever the number is, Pam. But for the most part, whether it's in television programs or advertising or whatever, we decided as a nation about 25 or 35 years ago, smoking is a bad idea. We haven't yet decided that about the overweight and obesity problem, and I just would submit that to you. Until we decide as a nation that this is something that's a big problem and that we really want to take a multifaceted approach to deal with, I don't think we're going to make progress. If I could just add one other thing, and some folks will once again say this is Roper blaming the victim, but colleagues in pediatrics in Arkansas with the public health community there started a program a number of years ago where every school child in Arkansas is weighed, stand on a bathroom scale, and they calculate body mass index, and that information is conveyed to parents so that people are have the information that they need to say, your family, your child needs help because of their weight problem. That's only one tiny thing, but I think we'd be better off if we did that.
All right. Dr. Rouse, did you want to comment on that at all?
I was going to say, I recall some stop smoking programs I knew about that they, after someone stopped smoking, they had a diet control program afterwards. As you stop smoking, of course, you might be eating more. But one of the solutions that other states have taken is for chains to have to include the calorie count of various items on their menu so that a consumer can make an informed decision of what they're going to order. I know Subway and others do that already, but I know in the state of New York that's done, so I don't know if it's been effective here. But
And let me ask, Ms. Chairman, let me ask one just different question to, I think, to Dr. Roper. But others may want to comment on this as well. I think we're in the process of developing the medical home model and supporting the medical home model in North Carolina. And I think that North Carolina may be as far along as any state out there in the medical home model. But I think one of the questions that's been raised is while we're making great progress there, that maybe one of the things that we need to work to catch up on is making sure we develop a mental health home as well on the behavioral health side. And then there's also a lot of discussion about making sure that we find ways that we can marry up the medical home with the mental health home because they're so intertwined with so many patients. And Dr. Roper, I don't know, you or Dr. Silverman may have some comments or thoughts about how we do that. Or maybe what are some considerations that we should be thinking about in making sure that we are actually coordinating and, you know, driving care, particularly for those people that we as a state are financially responsible for.
A couple of quick things, and then I'll defer to Dr. Silberman. I think we've had we paid a heavy price as a nation for the fact that we have for so many years separated the care of people with mental illness from all of the other issues in health care. We seem to be taking some tentative steps towards bridging that gap, and I think that's a very good thing. we've had the experience of if you go to our emergency department at UNC hospitals on a given day or night, a vast number of the people who are there have mental illness, and they also have physical ailments as well. But both of those need to be cared for, else their problems will continue. We've embarked on a pilot study in partnership with Blue Cross of North Carolina, looking at how to better care for people with chronic illness and lower the aggregate cost of their care. And one of the heavy targets of that is reaching people who have mental components to their illness and providing the care that they need to lower their costs. Final thing I'd say is, and I know this is a big issue that sits before the legislature and the incoming administration, but the great experiment that I would call it that began in the early 1960s of deinstitutionalizing people with mental illness, the notion was to take people out of the large state-run mental hospitals and have them live in the community where they'd be better cared for with community support services. That whole enterprise was flawed because we didn't have the community services to support people. And so we now, five decades later, are still caught up in that problem. And we are in partnership with Wake County government and others in this community trying to do some innovative things to provide better mental health services to the citizens of Wake County. But this is a big, big issue.
There's only a couple things that I would add to it. I want to elaborate on one of the things that Dr. Roper said and just talk about the urgency of us addressing the very point that you raised, Representative Dollar. If you don't address the mental health problems, it is going to be extraordinarily difficult to do all the things that Dr. Roper is going to have to do. Readmission rates, the people who are most likely to come back into the hospital are people with underlying depression or mental health problems, because when they get back, they don't have the capacity to make sure that they're following all the requirements that they need to do in order to stay out of the hospital. So the people that they're having the most difficulty with are the people with underlying mental health problems. That's why I think it's so critical that we do develop a system where we coordinate well between the mental health home and the primary care home. On the Medicaid side, you all did a couple years ago something that I thought was really at the forefront of what's happening around the country, which is you incentivized primary care practices to embed into those primary care practices psychiatric social workers or mental health, behavioral health providers in the primary care home. It worked really well for our children's, for our pediatric homes, because most of the kids had health insurance coverage so that there was a source of payment to pay for those licensed clinical social workers. It didn't work as well for our family practices or our internal medicine practices because there were so many uninsured patients that they didn't have a source of payment to pay for the behavioral health side of it. So I think as we move forward and there is some more insurance coverage, we may want to revisit whether there's a way to embed behavioral health folks into primary care practices and, in addition, embed primary care folks into behavioral health settings. Because what we know is for the low acuity folks, they may never get into the mental health system. For people who have depression, where they're going for care is their primary care provider. But if their primary care provider isn't treating the depression, it goes untreated. So I think there has to be a lot more work together of really integrating those two systems. I know in the legislation that you all put forward as you moved to the behavioral health 1915 BC waiver, you have this requirement in there that the CCNC networks work in close partnership with the LME MCOs. And I think that's going to be a really critical factor as we move forward to make sure that those two organizations are working together to manage the care of their patient population.
Thank you.
Representative Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions. The first one for Dr. Rouse, please. You were talking about the vaccines internationally, and I know I've been reading articles a number of times recently that there have been concerted efforts to scare people about the medications and everything. What is the current status on that, and how are you being able to combat that and kind of get ahead of that bad information?
So are you talking about the international vaccinations? Yeah. You're exactly right. You're well informed that there have been scare tactics, that it's these other countries coming in and trying to harm our people. Again, it goes back to evidence-based practice, and we look at thought leaders in the country that are well-respected, clinical leaders that are well-respected in the country, and have them speak out and present the evidence as much as is possible. It's difficult to get to everyone, but because once a rumor starts, it's difficult to turn that around. But to find the people who are well-respected thought leaders in the country to speak out against those untruths. Thank you.
Thank you. Follow-up for Dr. Roper, please. Dr. Roper, you talked very positively about capitation, and I have some questions about moving in that direction. I think we've seen with our LME conversion to MCOs, we've got a culture that's been used to provide a service and get paid. Now you're getting paid, and you got to use your money the right way type of a deal. We saw, at least I've seen, that systems weren't in place to correctly monitor and everything. Will we be able to do that currently, or are we going to be smarter and take the time to prepare for that change if and when it comes, and how would we go about it?
Thank you, Ms. Avila. It is it's true that I was advocating capitation, but I strongly agree with your cautionary note. And I think the way to deal with those two sides of the coin, if you will, is to say, let's not just day one capitate the whole program for the whole state if we're talking about Medicaid, but I think it would be an appropriate thing to try some demonstration projects to see if these ideas make sense in some portion of the state. But I think there have been too many I can't think of any other word to say, but scandals with regard to Medicaid capitation in other states. There have been too many of those for us simply to ignore that and say, oh, it'll all go well, because the regulatory oversight, the scrutiny, the transparency, the safeguards that are needed all have to be in place, as you were saying, before this is going to work.
Further questions, Senator Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I guess this question would be offered to anybody that has any information about it. It appears to me as though a significant driver for increased health care costs is compliance with regulation. Has anybody done a study on the cost-benefit analysis of these?
I think that's the great unanswered question.
I guess the answer is no, then.
By regulation, you mean general regulation that physicians or hospitals submit to, or insurance regulation? I'm unsure which.
Yeah. Well, state and federal regulations.
Yeah. I'm sure there is a large-scale cost to it. I don't know of a study, to answer your question, that attempts to quantify.
I wonder if we just don't want to know the answer is why we're not studying it. I don't know. I have one other question, Mr. Chairman, if I may, and I guess this is directed to Dr. Roper. And it appears as though an integral part of costs containment, according to what you said, is incentivizing physicians, practices, hospitals, any healthcare provider on outcomes. And yet, if I'm hearing you correctly, any attempt to hold patients responsible for their lifestyle choices is blaming the victim. Could you help me bridge that gap?
Well, I think you heard me say I'm in favor of that, but there are some people who criticize what I was advocating and call it blaming the victim, but I don't do that. So I guess if you're asking for me to explain this disparity, it's simply not everybody agrees with me, if I can make a joke about it, but there you go.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment and perhaps a question. If there is a question here, I would probably direct it to Dr. Roper, since you were talking more about national issues and trends. And I guess it just seems to me that any conversation that we have about our public health trends and some of the things that we've talked about that are related, such as poverty, such as lifestyle choices, as you've talked about, I just think we should consider the fact that during our lifetimes, I would say over the last two generations, we've seen a significant trend away from two-parent families. You know, children that are no longer born into a family with a mother and a father. And I know that there have been significant studies in the areas of health care, in the area of poverty, that directly tie poverty rates and health care outcomes to the condition of the family. And I don't know if you have any comments that you would like to make regarding that, or any thoughts as you've studied the issue, as you would relate that. But I just felt like this conversation ought to not forget that 800-pound elephant in the room that we have to deal with as well.
Repeated studies have shown that intact families provide a more stable environment for all the things that Dr. Silberman talked about so eloquently in her presentation. No question about it.
Further questions from members of the committee for our panel? Senator Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I want to go back to Dr. Roper, if I may. Dr. Roper, in your 5 points, you talk about that there are no one likes international comparisons, but people in America don't get all the care that they need, and that there are many international comparisons that provide better care than the American system does. Could you share with me those countries that you're comparing that stat to?
I don't have the number, the list. I'll be happy to send it to you, Senator Tucker. In the most recent international comparison I've seen, we rank 37th, I believe, among nations of the world in the outcomes of care from our health system, broadly speaking. So I will be pleased to give you the full list, but we rank well down the list.
Sir, would it be fair to say that most of those countries are socialist and have, state-run health care systems or nationally-run health care systems like Great Britain, yeah, Italy, Spain, Greece, that are all broke?
Many of them do, but that's not my point. It is that we simply ought to apply American ingenuity and American values to doing better here for our country. We can do better.
Okay, follow-up, sir. I understand the consolidation that you're talking about, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, sir, that whether we like it or not, it's happening everywhere. If we've got one-sixth of our economy tied to medicine and health care, with the Affordable Care Act and what you see in your presentation, your fourth point was cost is not a problem, and of course, I don't see how adding 37 million people to an insurance roll is going to reduce cost. Can you help me with that vision, sir?
Yeah, I didn't say it in my remarks, but I have many times said I believe the major flaw in the Affordable Care Act is it doesn't treat cost seriously enough, nearly seriously enough. And as you said in your question, it's a major problem to add to the cost of what is already the world's most costly healthcare system. We're going to be the universe's most expensive healthcare system, I guess. That said, I think there are some practical things that we can do, some of which we've talked about now, others we could talk about later, to lower the cost of care, or at least lower the rate of increase of the cost of care. The point that I was trying to make is we simply shouldn't throw up our hands and say healthcare is always going to be terribly expensive. Just get used to it.
Thank you. Just from a street perspective, my health insurance at my company with 84 employees jumped 19%. It's averaging anywhere from 9 to 20% a year. Continues to go up. I'm going to have to make a decision to throw my employees into the Affordable Care Act and let them fend for themselves in the government system, and it's just kind of going that way.
And most small business employers are facing exactly that choice. You're right.
Further questions from members of the committee? Hearing none, thank you very much. I'm sorry, Senator Brock. Excuse me.
Sorry, back here for the back row. Just hold over from being a from church on Sunday. Just one question. We're looking at trying to design a system on behavior of people, and you're looking at financial incentives to give to patients. But we're looking at the healthcare cost. I think when you started off, you said that people get all the healthcare that they need, but we're looking at basing the healthcare and cost on people that practice all the healthcare that they need. And being someone who exercised at one time and ate healthy, and I don't do that anymore, how do we get people to change their behavior, and especially those that we're paying for that are they're not paying for healthcare right now? I mean, what type of financial incentive do you have with people that, you know, on Medicaid, they don't have to pay their copay? So how do we change their behavior?
So there are a number of important points that you covered there. I'll try to respond to some of them. One, I'm a strong believer in copayments, and they ought to be copayments that are meaningful, not trivial, so that individuals face a real decision about whether to access care. On the other hand, they shouldn't be so large as to keep people who actually need care but can't otherwise afford it from getting care, because otherwise we pay as a society a cost for that. You ask how to get people to exercise and eat right, et cetera. Again, I would put in either for public programs or private health insurance for firms. You can design a plan that says you have to pay more for your insurance if you're a smoker or if your body mass index is over level, or you can provide a positive incentive and say, I'll give you a break on your insurance premiums if you are in an exercise program or a regular attendee at a fitness center or whatever. We can do these things if we put our mind to it, is my broad point.
Just to follow up, but what do we do with the people that are not paying for it?
Then we charge them more, and they pay a financial penalty for it. Ultimately, I think I don't want to obfuscate and miss the importance of your question. It is, if I can rephrase it, how do we do this given the underlying compassion of the American people, and we're not going to, for the most part, leave people out in the cold on the street, whatever, even if they have made what many of us would view as the wrong choices in their life or whatever. That's one of the central quandaries of all of this. And if I can just summarize lots of what I've tried to say today, the fact that we can't do everything and that we can't make it absolutely perfect, it should not be a reason for not doing the things that we know we can do to make it incrementally better.
Dr. Rouse, Dr. Roper, and Dr. Silberman, we thank you all very much for this most informative panel discussion, and we certainly look forward to working with you in the upcoming term as we continue to wrestle with these problems for the health care of our citizens in our state. Thank you so much. We have another panel that has been assembled. The first speaker is Beth Lovett, who's going to speak on local public health challenges. She is with the she's the health director of the Appalachian District Health Department. We're glad to have you with us.
Good morning. I am Beth Lovett. I'm the health director, as Senator Pate mentioned, of the Appalachian District Health Department. I'm also the president of the North Carolina Association of Local Health Directors, and it is my privilege and honor to be here today, chairman, committee members, staff, and others. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm going to share with you, let's see, I'm going to try to coordinate my hands here. It's an amazing privilege to be following a panel such as this, and even more exciting when I realize my slides, my presentation, actually fits in so nicely with the work of these experts, these true experts. In local public health, we deal with really two areas of health, the public's health or the population's health in the communities we serve, personal health services for the people that come through the door to receive services or in the case of environmental health, when we go out the door to provide services. So local health departments strengthen communities. Our new favorite phrase is public health equals public wealth. In fact, I can't tell you where I heard this, and I can't quote the statistic, but what I've heard is that as companies are evaluating communities in terms of moving locations or opening their doors, they're looking at the health of our school systems, our graduation rate. And next, they're looking at our obesity rates. And so public health certainly does have an opportunity to impact public wealth. Another interesting thought, and I'm not going to read these slides to you, but another interesting point that was raised earlier was even in the management of communicable disease and the spread of outbreaks. While we no longer have nearly as many active TB patients in North Carolina, local public health departments are responsible for the control and the spread of tuberculosis patients. So a resource-intensive responsibility of your local health department is for active tuberculosis patients providing directly observed therapy. So the staff of the health department either goes out to provide the medicine, watch the patient take it, or the patient comes in if they're a patient compliant and willing to do so. So I thought that was an interesting link to the forest, to the trees. We also uphold policies, and one of our favorite policies to uphold because of the incredible impact that this legislation had on the health of North Carolinians is the legislation for smoke-free bars and restaurants. And you can see in our example that this policy change has contributed to a 21% decrease in emergency room visits for heart attacks secondary to smoke-free bars and restaurants, and has improved air quality by 89% in those venues. Our wonderful law also earns high approval ratings, and that is one of the things that local public health departments are responsible for enforcing. But another example of this is how we play well with others. Boards of health in North Carolina often are very helpful in the collaboration as we encourage stakeholders in the community, such as our boards of education, to consider how we can move more toward the very policies we talked about earlier about physical activity and improving nutrition. A couple of local pictures here I find interesting. The picture on the left is from Fleetwood Elementary School. These kids have enjoyed the benefits of the Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant, which is a CDC initiative to help fight obesity. They learned all about healthy foods. They grew and tasted and cooked and enjoyed healthy foods along with physical activity initiatives. And the second picture on that slide, I actually snapped with my cell phone last week when I was at a great collaborative meeting and Parks and Rec folks. So we made Parks and Rec magazine, with the relationship between parks in North Carolina and public health. What else are we doing? You know well that we keep the food and physical environment safe for the community through our restaurant inspections, our food and lodging inspections. Again, we track and trend the disease. What you may not know is that every reportable disease in North Carolina is tracked by your local health department. It's reported either through the physician practice that catches the disease or the laboratory that finds the positive test, and it's goes through our electronic system with the state to help track and prevent negative trends. And, of course, you know that we did not enjoy national attention with the E. coli outbreak with North Carolina's state fair, but that was handled through a wonderful collaboration between health departments who participated in the investigation and worked with local hospitals and doctor's offices, informed the public, and really helped to contain the incident. We also assure a safety net, and there's been discussion today, and I'm going to show a slide that echoes what the earlier presenters mentioned, but we are a part of assuring the safety net, and it varies from community to community, but we are actively providing health care in public health departments in many cases and collaborating with private and public partners, community health centers, and rural health centers for that safety net. We understand that prevention works, and we do believe that access to preventive services for everyone, including low-income folks, is very important. We were thrilled to achieve in North Carolina 2010, our infant mortality rate declined sharply, and that trend underscores the impact of public health programs that were aimed at improving birth outcomes and maternal and child health. I think one of the challenges, though, is when this General Assembly or our federal partners or even the wonderful partners in grants we have through Kate B. Reynolds and the Duke Endowment and others, if we use an evidence-based program and we make this kind of a difference, but then the funding goes away, does the program cease to exist, and then do we see a bounce back in our statistics? And I don't know that we can afford to find that out in all cases. We've already heard from folks, is North Carolina healthy? We are doing pretty well for a southern state, but there certainly are communities in North Carolina that are among the most unhealthy places to live. We've already covered the state health rankings, just a small commercial message for North Carolina. This graph compares us to our southeastern partner states. And we are proud that in spite of some of our social and economic factors, North Carolina has produced better overall outcomes than 7 of 9 peer states, which had better ranking for children living in poverty, better overall health outcomes than 4 of our 9 peer states, which had better national averages for funding, and better outcomes of the 7 peer states that had better unemployment rates. My friends at the Division of Public Health helped put, and Healthy North Carolina 2020 helped put this county health ranking slide together. And it doesn't show the 100 counties, but what it does show is the top couple and the bottom couple, and then it shows the quartiles in between. The health outcome rankings by the county health rankings represent how healthy a county is. The rankings measure 2 types of health outcomes, how long people live, which is their mortality, and how healthy they feel while they're alive, those morbidity statistics. And the health factors, that second column, represent what influences the health of a county, and they measure 4 types: health behaviors, the clinical care, social and economic situation, and the physical environment of the county. And this is kind of the evidence of the global picture to the national picture, to the state picture, to the county level of how the rankings are impacted by the rate of uninsured. You can look in that far column and see how the more uninsured folks you have in the community, the worse their health rankings are, and that same follows for children in poverty and across the grid. And unfortunately, the highest adult obesity rates are in the counties that are the poorest and have the least lives covered with health insurance. I have some great stories to tell, and I really meant to tell you right up front that I think that I have probably one of the best jobs in North Carolina. I love working in local public health. It's always interesting, always something new going on. So it's a privilege to tell you what we're doing in local public health today. And I promise I'm going to get to the challenges as well. We are transforming communities through the state's community transformation grant that we received in North Carolina through the CDC. We are natural, neutral conveners in public health in counties in North Carolina. We aren't big players in terms of an employer, but we are great at pulling people together and getting folks to talk. We have excellent collaboration in North Carolina with the Division of Public Health. They provide services to us that we can't afford to replicate at the county level. Wonderful work in epidemiology and evidence-based practice and advice such as that. We've already talked about immunizations and the excellent legislation we have around school requirements for immunizations. We've even seen, since House Bill 2, we've seen Durham and Orange County take a couple of steps even beyond House Bill 2, collaborating with their local health department, local boards of health, local county commissioners to move toward a more comprehensive smoke-free policy. But I wanted to mention to you last week, I was a participant in the Northwest Partnership for Public Health. That's kind of our Region 3 health director group, and we are part of the regional effort for the Community Transformation Grant. We had a leadership team meeting last Friday, and I know you'll be interested to hear the kinds of representatives that were able to join us across 10 counties. We had county government, county commissioners, county managers, school systems, people doing food system work like the Second Harvest Food Bank. We had community colleges, Appalachian State, Smart Start, Parks and Recreation. That's where I got that magazine cover. City planners, county planners, folks in public health. And we were thrilled, as always, to see Dean Ledbetter, who lives in Wilkes County and works for Department of Transportation, who's been just absolutely wonderful in helping all of us understand the built environment and the impact on the health of the communities we serve. We do still, and I have to keep emphasizing this, we do still provide direct services in many health departments in North Carolina. Over half of the local health departments in North Carolina provide a primary care medical home. Many, such as the ones that I work in Watauga, Allegheny, and Ashe counties, are striving toward patient-centered medical home status. But we're doing it in a different model, and even in my three-county district, I can share the different perspectives. In Allegheny County, a small county with a struggling hospital, I feel like the local health department will always be a critical player in the provision of primary care, both for safety net and non-safety net folks. We do bill health insurance as needed. We are currently so thankful to receive funding from the Golden Leaf Foundation and Kate B. Reynolds for Allegheny County to help improve our primary care program. In Ashe County, we work with a free clinic, the Health Net Project, the hospital, and we've received some community state dollars to help help support the infrastructure of the primary care picture in Ashe County. In Watauga County, we have a unique situation. We're partnering with and, in fact, housing a newly funded federally qualified health center. So in Watauga County, our staff will be continuing to provide the primary care services, but will be through a subcontract relationship with High Country Community Health, the new federally qualified health center, so that we can take advantage of those federal dollars. So I wanted to share that example to tell you that we're willing to do whatever it takes at the local level, and it often looks different from community to community. I want to make the point of accreditation, which has raised the bar and standardized local health department work, and I mentioned already that we are community conveners. I'm getting to the slide of the moment, I think, our challenges. And I know that you were not surprised to see that funding remains at the top of the list. Public health at the federal, state, and local level continues to receive funding that is very siloed, earmarked for very specific pieces, you know, very specific programs. And it's not that they're bad programs, but it limits a nimble response to what you might like to do at the local level in terms of making an impact on working with school systems, for example, on those BMI rates that we talked about earlier. We have data challenges. they're huge for us. We partner with the state on data, but we have challenges with the health information system. We have challenges getting timely, pulling together timely data and trying not to confuse you, the stakeholders, and others in our community with the county health rankings, which are very interesting but older data, and then the wonderful data that is available to us from the State Center of Health Statistics. But managing that data is critical, and the fact that we end up with a lot of siloed funding means that infrastructure in local public health departments around IT is quite challenging. We believe it is as well for the Division of Public Health that they need more support for IT and data management as well. I can imagine a dashboard, and this is what I'd love to see in my lifetime, a dashboard for public health where you have some criteria around the health of your population as we try to move infant mortality, obesity rates, tobacco rates, at the same time that I understand how much my clinical services are costing and how are the clinical outcomes for the patients that we serve directly. That's what we're shooting for. And I wanted to mention as well that we have responsibility for the community health assessment. We share that with our hospitals. We're working collaboratively with them. Funding is an issue as well for the important work around the community health assessment and then driving a community plan in response for the community health assessment. And again, it can go back to challenges with funding that we may have the morbidity and mortality statistics and the stakeholders involved at the local county level to move on a health issue that we can't figure out how to pay for pulling the people together and getting the work done. So that's a challenge. And my colleagues have already mentioned the shifting sands with the Affordable Care Act, waiting to see what happens. And I don't want to miss that example that's offered. If you take a look at the piece of the pie, local public health revenues by source, this is for fiscal year 10, which is the most recent data I could get my hands on. Medicaid revenue does continue to be an important part of the revenue stream for local health departments. A third of the funding that we receive at the local level is generated by the work that we do. That 33%, which is so important to local public health, represents 1% of the total budget with the North Carolina Medicaid program. So I ask you that you keep that in mind. We are thrilled and excited with any opportunities to work with Community Care of North Carolina and the brains around the table in terms of how do we move from that fee-for-service model into something where we have a better stake in the outcomes. We've already started that in North Carolina with a partnership with Community Care, which is the Pregnancy Care Management Program and the Care Coordination for Children, where we're paid instead of per visit, we're paid based on the population that they expect us to serve, and then we're measured on our outcomes. So that's a new program, and we're excited to be a part of it. The other pieces of the pie, you can see the local appropriation in the orange, the federal appropriation, which will swell these years during the Communities Putting Prevention to Work grant for health departments like ours, but the Community Transformation Grant from the CDC will kind of swell that federal piece of the pie, which is just terrific for North Carolina. We have a health department in every county. Even district health departments like mine have a health department in every county, and we work well, we believe, to provide necessary health promotion, prevention, and protection work. I've already mentioned the infrastructure that needs improvement, so this slide just reiterates that. I want to say a huge thank you. It looks like the funding that you set aside for local health departments, $4.8 million, that was dependent on Medicaid achieving their budget goals in the first 6 months of the fiscal year, looks like it's coming to us, and we are ready and willing to spend this money. And the way the legislation is written gives us a great deal of flexibility, and for that we are thankful. Obesity, physical activity, smoking, school nurses, to just name a few. And I want to give you a kind of an independent commercial message. So this is not Beth Lovett speaking on behalf of all the public health department directors, but Beth Lovett speaking on her own. In terms of just an idea, we know that the patient-centered medical home model is the ideal model for the direct provision of care. We also know that As children age, they are less likely to be receiving the care that they need in a patient-centered medical home. That's why school-based health centers are so critical. That's why school nursing is so critical. I would love to see a day when school nursing in North Carolina would be under the direct leadership of public health to really work toward improving the management of the care of those students. Today in North Carolina, there are school nurses housed in public health. There are school nurses funded by you through public health to the school system. There are school nurses employed by the school system, and there are school nurses employed by the hospitals, and there are school nurses employed by a variety of those combinations. So that's my editorial comment on a way that we can really impact the health of the students that we serve. Our association does have 5 legislative priorities, and the top 2 really fit more into the day-to-day work that we do that you can kind of come to the health department and see in a way. And the bottom 3 relate to policy that's in your hands. The first one is supporting an increase in food and lodging fees. Our restaurant inspections are critical to the health and safety of the food supply in North Carolina. Currently, inspections are provided, and restaurants and inspected facilities pay $75 a year for the inspections. That money goes to the state. It's divided up between the state and the counties, and it doesn't cover a fraction of the cost of the service. So this is carried largely at the local level. But what we commit to you is that, as this is our number one legislative priority this year for local health departments, we are working very closely with our partners at Division of Public Health and the North Carolina Restaurant Association, and we feel very hopeful that what we bring to you would be acceptable to all 3 stakeholders in that. The second issue is the accreditation program, which is mandated in state law for local public health departments. We're real proud of that. We're the first state in the nation to mandate accreditation for local health departments. We believe in it at the local level. The funding was removed. There is a national accreditation program that is optional and provided at the national level. It's very, very expensive, and is modeled after the North Carolina accreditation program, but we think not quite as good. And we would ask that you consider funding accreditation, and hopefully to see that in a recurring line item somewhere tucked away where it doesn't become like a ping pong ball of we're in, we're out, we're in, we're out. The last 2 have been covered very well by my colleagues around tobacco issues in North Carolina, so I will not belabor that point. But again, it's been my privilege to talk with you today, and just an honor to serve the community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lovett. Next on the panel is Mandy Stone, who is the Buncombe County Assistant County Manager's Health and Human Services Director.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to talk about challenging facing local departments of social services in North Carolina. I'm going to begin by just reiterating that you heard much of this from the panelists earlier this morning. But in North Carolina, local departments of social services administer state and federal mandated programs. Most of those programs are built on the belief that while government has a role to remove obstacles, that individuals are ultimately responsible for the choices they make for themselves and their families. Whether you're challenged on the state level or on the county level, one thing is clear. Social service programs and health programs are probably your largest and fastest growing segment of the budget. That requires that we be strategic about what we want to accomplish by the investment of public dollars and how we move those forward. All right. In the course of my career, I've seen social service programs move from programs that encourage long-term dependence to programs that focused on short-term supports to individuals and families that helped move them to periods of self-sufficiency where they no longer relied on government services. I'm going to talk because I don't think it's going to move. No, that's okay. One of the points, and I'd like to thank this body for their support in their past and their continued support in the future. But it's really important in social service programs that local administration is critical to our success. The reason for that is that most core government services are most effective when they're united with other community partners, be they faith-based, private business, nonprofits, or for-profits, and that each community has very unique resources to bring to bear in order to leverage state and federal and local funds. Significant local funding investments in DSSs are also made across the state of North Carolina by county government. So it's important that the administration of these programs be local and be based on local community needs. If you could see the PowerPoint, for those of you who have it in front of you, in terms of talking about challenges, I wanted to use the example of where North Carolina has been very successful, because I think the success in the example in your PowerPoint is that North Carolina leads the nation in the lowest percentage of children who reenter foster care following their exit. One of the reasons that I believe we were most successful in this area is that you, lawmakers, were very clear about your objectives, that we were very clear about how to align resources and policy and work processes and supports to achieve that desired outcome. You think about the breadth and scope of social services in North Carolina. It's very important for us to be strategic, understanding what we want to accomplish as we decide how to align resources and work processes. Also want to make the point that it's important for the public to understand why it's a good investment of public resources. It's easy to argue from an emotional standpoint that permanence to any child is the right thing to do. But it's equally important to understand that for children to achieve permanence in a family setting is a good business decision. Research tells us that children who grow up in the foster care system ultimately bear large costs to our public systems in terms of courts and jails and schools and health care. They have poor health outcomes, much of the discussion this morning. So it's also, when we decide how to invest our public resources, we need to look at what's the right thing to do, as well as where can the public see that was the right public investment to make. What we ultimately all want, whether they're our own children or children that we own responsibility for as a public agency, is to position our kids to be productive adults and to invest resources in a way that accomplishes that. What I would say about the example that I just went through, where North Carolina has been one of the most successful states in the nation, is we know what drove that success. And we can use those factors to drive future success. We need to clearly understand what our lawmakers want us to accomplish. We need to understand the metrics you need to see to see that accomplishment move forward. We need to understand who we're serving in terms of our customers. And in the DSS system, our customers have changed dramatically during the recession. We serve people who've never sought public services before, mostly working people, and we have to deliver services that allow them to continue to work and be self-sufficient. We've also, from both a federal and state level, continued to entwine into social service laws and programs focus on individual and personal responsibility. Government has a role, but people are ultimately responsible for how they and their families move forward. We have to look at partnerships, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a few slides as well, but partnerships across county lines, regional opportunities, partnerships within our own communities, and partnerships from county to county across the state. North Carolina has invested, and I hope continues to invest, in how we simplify work and invest in technology. How do we achieve administrative savings that help offset the cost of ever-increasing social service programs? And how do we capitalize on the unique assets of every county in North Carolina through that local administration? What experience tells us and what research tells us is that we're most successful when we target our efforts across multiple agencies and we work in a coordinated fashion. When we engage citizens and assure that they're accountable for their own movement forward and that of their families. Where we use evidence-based practice, we share tools and data and invest in what's working, replicate programs that we know are working. This is a map, though hard to see, that I think is really important in light of the conversation this morning. And this is reflective of some of the work that we're doing in Buncombe County. The purple dots represent all the recipients of WIC through the Public Health Department, and the blue dots, all the recipients in Buncombe County of Supplemental Nutrition Program, or the old food stamps. What this map tells us, the lines are drawn by both zip codes and school districts. What this map tells us is that there's 60% of the people who are served in both of those programs. It's important that we look at data to understand who we serve and what other public agencies we share consumers with, how we can align resources across agencies and achieve administrative efficiencies. Also want to make the point in light of the panelists' discussion this morning that there is opportunity when we invest public resources in looking at how can we achieve better health outcomes for individuals who either their health care and or their food assistance comes through public resources. How can we target public health promotion and health education, access to public parks, and access to school recreational facilities on those populations that we know are at highest risk and are supported through public dollars. That means understanding consumers across systems and looking at ways to serve consumers across individual agencies and systems. This is an additional example of that, where in Buncombe County we've mapped where are we providing Family Nurse Partnership, an evidence-based prevention program aimed at first-time moms who are at high risk of abuse or neglect. The heat-sensored pattern is where are we providing child protective services intervention into families identified for abuse and neglect. And the different colors on the map are the school districts and where we have school nurses located. It's another example of where we can achieve better public outcomes and more effectively use public dollars if we look at serving individuals and families across agency silos. And we share public resources with focus on how we achieve better outcomes. What I think that the DSS system most needs in terms of the challenges that face us is the opportunity for a redesigned business architect. And we'll talk about that in terms of our challenges. One is that, as I mentioned before, DSS administers mandated services. And first and foremost, we'd ask from our elected officials that as you distribute federal block grants, you make sure that you fund those services that are mandated. Those in the TANF block grant include Child Protective Services and Adult Protective Services, as well as County Work First block grants, which is basically aimed at moving people to work. That you prioritize funding those services that you've mandated in law or that the federal government has mandated in law. That we fund mandated guardianship services to protect senior and disabled adults. That we fill the gaps created by the federal 4E funding cuts to protect abused and neglected children, and that we maximize child care subsidy funding to benefit North Carolina's eligible children. I'll just use this slide to demonstrate that we project the growth, particularly in adult protective services, will continue to trend upward. It is estimated that in North Carolina by 2025, 85 of the 100 counties will have more people over the age of 60 than under the age of 17. I think as we strategically align public resources with what the data tells us the needs of the future will be, we have to pay attention to the needs in adult protective services. I'd like to use this slide just to talk about the priority that I mentioned related to filling the gap, related to federal changes in how we fund in 4E funding. If you look at North Carolina, North Carolina has been very successful in reducing the number of children in foster care. We know, as the mini graph at the top shows you, that the most expensive type of care we provide in a social service program to children is children who cannot safely remain home and move into the foster care system. We're very concerned that the loss of FORE funding and the loss of the opportunity to provide intensive in-home services to stabilize a family and prevent the need for removal or stabilize the placement for children with kin will move us into an upward trend of the number of children in foster care in the future. Ask you to pay attention that the average cost of providing in-home intervention to a family is less than $8,000 a year compared to the cost per child in foster care of $86,000 a year. Why it's very important for us to strategically invest public resources in prevention and early intervention. I would also ask you, as I tried to demonstrate with the geo-mapping, that we really have to break down silos across state departments. DSS is administer programs for many departments across health and human services. If you think about the challenges we know we face in our adult care homes, in our mental health system, or in early childhood education, it means we have to look across silos and departments and talk about how we strategically invest public resources to achieve the greater good with the most effective and efficient use of those public dollars. Also ask you to continue to support NCFAST and the investment in technology and simplification, to focus on policy simplification. How do we align our work processes across multiple public assistance programs? How do we integrate case coordination and case management to as effectively and efficiently deliver services as we can? How can we share real-time data across counties in North Carolina through a shared information system? And understanding that those investments in technology will also support improved program integrity, meaning assuring that people get the benefits to which they're entitled, but only the benefits to which they're entitled. Just understand that you face, as do counties, many challenging decisions as you move into the budget, and would just ask you to consider how the decisions you make will affect individuals and families and communities across North Carolina far into the future, and to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Thank you, Ms. Stone, and now we'll get into our panel questions. I would like to ask a question of Ms. Stone on one of her slides that she had up there, and it doesn't have a number on the page, but it says Child and Family Services Fiscal Year 12 with Nurse Family Partnership. I don't know if we can get back to that. Could we get the slides back again so we can put that one back up? That's the one. In your remarks, did you say something about school nurses?
Yes. Actually, what showed on this geo map, if you look at, and we try not to do this by address because of the confidentiality issues, but if you look at the lighter color, those are CPS, Child Protective Services cases and intervention. The different larger districts of the map represent school districts where we have school nurses, and the little blue dots represent family nurse partnership cases, which is a evidence-based prevention program offered through the health department to first-time moms at risk of abuse or neglect. It's an example where if you look across services delivered in various health and human service departments, you can be more focused about how you both expend resources and how you measure outcomes. Are we making a difference? Are we beginning to, by the investment in Family Nurse Partnership by Buncombe County, will we begin to see a decrease in the number of Child Protective Service cases? And what are the roles school nurses play in that? When DSS intervenes in a family and ultimately closes a case, what role can the school nurse play in helping to facilitate services for the family and also serving as an ongoing monitor? So it's just another example of how do we pull across multiple departments to have a greater bang for the public buck.
I believe you have two school systems in Buncombe County. Are both of them, do they have the proportionate amount of school nurses that equalize each other, or is one less than the other?
No, they do have. And school nurses are an area where our county commissioners have made a significant local investment because they believe that school nurses have an impact not only in coordination of health care, but in health promotion and education and in child abuse prevention. So we have made that investment to have school nurses equally across the city and county school systems.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee for the panelists? Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On one of the pages you had mentioned, Ms. Stone, foster care, and you had the cost of $86,100. Could you, I'm not that familiar with foster care, but could I get some information, itemized information on how that equates this per child? I was curious as how you calculated that.
I would be very happy to share that information. A group of counties in the West work with the state to quantify those numbers. And I'll be happy to share with you the detail of that.
Thank you.
Further questions from members of the committee? Representative Murray, I'll get this button right after a minute.
How are you, sir? I'd have a question about the public health presentation that we heard. I was interested in the immunization registry, and do you think... What do you think the percentage of immunizations that are administered are actually uploaded into the immunization registry as an indicator of public health for that marker?
I don't know the percentage. I know that we have a great opportunity to improve the percentages as the Health Information Exchange stands up in North Carolina. The North Carolina Immunization Registry will be a part of that and allow the data that's in the immunization registry to flow, I'm hoping, both ways. But I've heard from private providers that as they go to electronic health records, they're not going to stop and enter data in the registry separately from in their electronic health records. So it's a challenge. But I think it's a challenge with a solution down the road with the Health Information Exchange.
Thank you.
Further questions from members of the committee? Senator Allran.
Thank you. Back to that slide that you have up there, right there, $86,000 a year would be over $7,000 a month. Yes.
That's true. And when you look at, and I'm happy to send you
My question is, how could it possibly cost that much?
That would include the cost associated with the direct social work time, any of the actual residential placement components, in addition to the processes that are required in court related to that, services that you're required to provide to the families or individuals as a result of those court orders. And that is data that a group of counties in the West worked with the state to verify, and that's an average number. I'd also note that one of the shifts in the foster care system in North Carolina has been the number of children who we avoid, as that chart shows you, coming into care through kin or relative placement. Often the children who do ultimately enter care enter with a substantial mental health, physical health, and behavior academic problems. So it captures all of those costs.
figures can be difficult, and I don't know how they would calculate things in other states, so I don't know if you could even compare, but do we have any idea how our costs compare with other states?
I do not know that today. That was part of what got looked at, and I'd be happy to forward that as well.
Further questions from members of the committee? Yes, Senator Hartzell, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is from Ms. Lovett. Couple things. One, it's my understanding that reimbursements for primary care services provided by local health departments are less than they are for other types of providers providing similar kinds of things. Is that correct?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Reimbursements from?
Medicaid.
That
you receive for providing the same service that is provided by, whether independent clinics, whether it's provided by fairly qualified health care centers or otherwise, your reimbursement is less than. Is that correct or not?
It's correct in comparison with the federally qualified health centers. I believe that it is received the same reimbursement from as private providers with that exception.
Okay. Then it's also my understanding that under the Affordable Care Act, services provided by health departments aren't even health departments aren't even mentioned in it. Is that
of the opportunities afforded safety net providers across the nation? Public health departments did get overlooked at the national level in terms of 340, that excellent pricing, 340B pricing for folks that we serve in the safety net and public health. We can only provide that medication through the 340B program for family planning and tuberculosis, where rural health centers, federally qualified health centers, and community health centers can provide that for all of their uninsured, low-income folks. That's one example.
Okay.
Further questions from members of the committee? Yes, Chairman Dollar.
Well, I wasn't going to ask. I told him, promised him I wasn't going to ask a question. But just to follow up on that, is the thinking there from the national level to, and I just want your thoughts on this, to get the local health departments out of the business of being a provider so much of health care, but being more of a coordinator of making sure that people are plugged into the system where it's appropriate, and to be more focused, the local health department attention more on the, whether it's regulatory in some shape, form, or fashion, or educational, that sort of thing. Is that what's going on here? What's your sense of it?
I think that's an excellent question. And my belief is, to a large part, we were overlooked at the national level because in the Southeast, we trend a little differently around local public health departments. And I believe in North Carolina, a part of that is the high percentage of local dollars that go into public health departments in North Carolina, which are kind of guided and driven by the boards of county commissioners and local boards of health who understand the need to provide the safety net. And so I sit on a national committee that looks at what I still think of as personal health services that are provided through local health departments. And we're a pretty loud voice in the Southeast and not so much in the rest of the country. And so I don't know if that can be teased out by funding sources or not. I don't think it's an intentional push out, actually. I think it's probably more of an oversight.
Thank you.
Senator Tucker.
Yes, sir. I know we want to go to lunch. I'll be brief. This question, I guess, for Ms. Lovett. Ms. Lovett, in the last session, we passed legislation that allowed the commissioners of each county to have more say-so over the health departments and a reporting piece of that for the health director, and there was some angst amongst your association about that. Can you give me a feel for what impact that has or hasn't had, or nothing's changed, or it's really insignificant, or what do you think?
I think it's sort of a moving target, all in motion. Among my colleagues in North Carolina, there are I wish I was good at pulling numbers off the top of my head, but I'm going to say 15 or so counties have moved in the direction of considering consolidation between health and DSS and some form of fashion. And some of them are still thinking through what it really means to them at the local level. In the communities I serve, as yet, as the School of Public Health study showed counties that are participating in a district model actually provide a little bit less funding for the district health department. And so we were able to share some overhead across smaller counties, and that has seemed to be something that in our neck of the woods the local county commissioners are happy with. And when they've taken a look at doing a financial analysis, we looked like a bargain, I think.
All right, thank you. One other follow-up question for Ms. Stone. Ms. Chairman, fine. Ms. Stone, in looking at your legislative priorities and just looking at your presentation in general, as we move into the era of possibly not as much in federal dollars coming down for health care systems and the Affordable Care Act, it seems that every one of your requests from the legislature is more money on all four categories. I consider TANF money and federal grants our money. The federal government is broke. It's $16 trillion in the hole or better, approaching $17. So block grants are, you know, those things are possibly, if they trim down entitlements, will go away. Am I correct in reading that, or
I don't believe the request what is related to additional money. It's that if the federal or state government makes a decision to mandate a service, that should receive priority in how those funds are distributed in a block grant environment. I think that when a program is mandated and the funding doesn't follow it, it doesn't mean that local counties in North Carolina cannot deliver the service or deliver less of it or deliver it slower. So I think the requests are not so much about more money, but aligning the expectations from a mandate, from what you adopt in state law, with the funds that and how you distribute the funds. The funds related to mandated guardianship services is really just a request that what happened is currently happening is that DSS will be the only disinterested public agent, and that guardianship cases move to DSS from the mental health system and much of the public health system, and that there has to be adequate funding to support that. So it's less about asking for additional dollars and more about asking that how those dollars are prioritized follows the expectations in the law, the expectations that lawmakers have about what we deliver and what we focus on.
Okay, Ms. Chair, just a comment. I concur with what you're asking or the examples that you've given here, but there will be that time when no funding is available that I would not, as a legislator, expect you to deliver services, i.e. the state or the federal government doesn't provide it and knows an okay answer, because we're going to reach that point at some time.
I understand that reality, and I also think it's why the investment North Carolina's made in the NCFAST system and technology is so important. We have to streamline the administrative side of the delivery of those services so we use those dollars to the best advantage possible.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions, thank you very much for your presentation. And I'd especially like to recognize Ms. Stone for the breakdown in your PowerPoint, and you continued right on. You're very agile, and I wanted to compliment you on that. It is time for lunch. We will reconvene this committee at 1:45. Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats, and we will get into Part B of our committee hearing for today. Our first presentation will be a Medicaid budget status report. It'll be given by Ms. Chloe Gossage from our committee staff, who is in the fiscal research. Ms. Gossage.
Good afternoon. I'm Chloe Gossage with the Fiscal Research Division, and this presentation will look very familiar to y'all. It's very similar to what we talked about last week or last month, with some updated figures showing where we are through the end of November. Last month we talked about through the end of October. So here's where we are on overall Medicaid expenditures, all fund sources including federal, state money. You can see that red line is actual year-to-date. The green line is the forecast that done by the department. And you can see we're just a little bit under in expenditures year-to-date by about $28 million or about 0.6%. On the revenue side, or compared to actual for last year, we're also under our last year actual at this point in time for total expenditures. On the revenue side, we're a little bit further under, comparing again the red line for actual to the green line for the forecast. We're under by about $93 million on revenue coming in. That's about 2.6%. So when you combine those two things together, or again, according, we're also under for last year at the same point in time. When you combine those two things together, the expenditures less the revenue, you get where we are in net state appropriations. And you can see here the red line is where we actually are compared to the green line of the forecast. And we're a little bit over on appropriation. That's kind of the result of being a little bit further under in receipts than we are in expenditures. It's a difference of about $62 million, or 4%. And comparing where we were last year at this time, you can see we are running under last year's actual expenditures. That's the orange line. But we are running a little bit closer to that orange line than we are to the green forecasted line. Where are we compared to last month? The end of October, total appropriations, just looking at the state dollars. End of October, we were about $83 million over compared to the end of November, we're about $64 million over. However, most of the overage in October was due to scheduling, timing of payments. The amount that wasn't due to scheduling was about $33 million. Through the end of November, the amount not due to scheduling has grown to $52 million. And then if we look just at the amount that's due to claims, we see we were about $26 million over in claims by the end of October, and about $40 million over in claims compared to the forecast at the end of November. Most of this is due to some payments in October. You can see the division here by quarters. You can see the latter end of the first quarter and the beginning of the second quarter. So mostly October payments were higher than anticipated in terms of the forecast. It's right in there. So that's that period right there is some of what's driving the increase in claims. And again, this check writes is not all claims, but it's most claims, and it's total dollars, not state appropriation, but it kind of follows the same trends. So, Mr. Chair, that's what I have in terms of an update. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Gossage. Questions from any of the members? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Gossage. Next item on the agenda is an update by Mr. Steve Owen, who is the Chief Business Operating Officer in the Division of Medical Assistance in DHHS, and he's wounded, so we've got someone operating a microphone for him. Mr. Owens, please go ahead with your briefing on the Medicaid budget update.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Like last month, what I want to do is really walk through four components, talk a bit about where we are from a cash perspective. I'll try not to repeat information that Chloe's already presented, give you some sense of kind of where we're going to end the year as well. Enrollment, utilization, and expenditures, how those are trending, where we are with CC&C through the first 5 months of the year, and really kind of end with a total forecast for the whole year. Each month, we actually do a reforecast or forecast our annual expenditures based on a variety of factors. We build in expected enrollment trends. We build in changes in consumption, changes in prices, and so forth. And I think I'll show you in a second, and I think in Chloe's graph, she also showed that January is going to when we did our original distribution, we had we expected a dip in October and a fairly dramatic rise in January. And I think what we're seeing is we didn't see the dip in October, and we're expecting at this point that January we're going to come in really pretty much eliminate the bulk of the claims variance by the end of January. Right now, when we look at our annual forecast using all of our information through for the first 5 months of the year, we're actually looking at a surplus at the end of the year from the claims perspective, about $5 million. Again, the numbers here are the same numbers, I think, that Chloe had showed earlier, with the addition I've added under the $52.3 million, which is where our cash position is against our weekly forecast, which, again, this was our first year doing this. Of the $52 million, just under $40 million was attributable to claims, $3.6 in administration and contracts, $7 million in program integrity, and $1.8 in settlements, our gap plan, and other payments. This week, or I guess since last month, one of the areas that we have seen some slowdown in, which is also affecting our annual forecast, is in the program integrity area. So we're monitoring those net recoveries to make sure we know what's going on with those and can make whatever appropriate adjustments as we go forward. This is a similar chart to what Chloe showed earlier. What you're looking at here is I've converted our claims expenditures to basically claims per day. So this shows you, for instance, in the very first one, in the week ending July 9th, which is our very first bullet, we were processing about $9.5 million of claims per day. So I'm trying to equalize here for the fact that some weeks we have more processing days so that you can see somewhat of the trend. In the month of October, you see the same gap. The red dotted line is the actual expenditures. The blue line is the forecast. So you see the same, I think, gap that you saw under Chloe's presentation when you get into the October time frame, where red line was above the forecasted weekly amount. When we get into January, what you see is, again, on a daily basis, we have a fairly dramatic rise in the month of January. So at this point, when we look at our annual forecast, looking at our weekly distribution, we think by the end of January we should see the claims variances moderate and actually be fully absorbed. From a utilization and enrollment perspective, again, there are three or four things that really drive Medicaid's expenditures. The first one, obviously, is the number of people that we have enrolled in the program. Through the end of November, we actually had, on average, about 8,000 less people enrolled in Medicaid, which, again, obviously, from an expenditure perspective, is a positive factor. However, you'll see in a minute, as similar to what we've seen in the prior months, is the mix of enrollment is different than what we expected. And by mix of enrollment, there are 14 different program aid categories. Aged, blind, and disabled are three of those program aid categories, which happen to be some of our most more expensive categories. We've seen a higher proportion of our overall enrollment in those categories, and we've actually seen as a percentage of our total less children. An average, as you see here, an aged, blind, and disabled recipient, we spend about $1,400 per month on those individuals. For a child, we spend about $222, per month. Since last month, what we've seen is a little bit of a flip-flop here between our ABD and our AFDC over 21s. But again, it's still the same general distribution variance in our more expensive categories. And so even though we've got less people enrolled, we continue to see an adverse mix of enrollees in terms of our expenditures. Again, just to give you some sense of this is how our enrollment basically has panned out for the four same categories over the past 4 or 5 years in terms of how our proportion of our population. I think it's important when you look at, for instance, our age, blind, and disabled, which really amount for about 25% of our total enrollment, they actually account for almost 60% of our total expenses. As we look at our overall budget every month, we really try to look at two different slices, if you will. The first one is, again, breaking it down by program aid category, which is what we were just talking about in terms of things, the areas like age, blind, and disabled, children, and other categories. We also break down our expenditures into various groupings or buckets, if you will, of expense. For instance, we really divide all of our expenses up into five categories. Medicaid is a fairly large program with a lot of complex things going back and forth. We use these groupings, if you will, to try to help us understand basically what's happening, are there trends emerging, things that we need to be focused on. As you'll see in a minute, I've actually given you some trends and how our expenditures are on a per member per month basis. But again, foundation is basically our physician drugs and dental services. Medical expenses are, most for the most part, hospital diagnostic and treatment. Long-term residential would be, for the most part, nursing homes and personal care services. Behavioral health is a composite of our ICFMRs, inpatient psychiatric hospitals, our professional services, CAP programs, as well as the MCO fees that we pay. This is what our expenditures have looked like in 2010, 11, and 12, and then for each month so far this year. So as an example, you can see for our foundation, again, which are physicians, dental, and drugs for the most part, we were spending $168, almost $169 per recipient per month back in 2010. We saw that drop in 11 to around 166 back up in 2012, and then you can see the trends that we've actually seen over this year. So at the end of November, we're spending about $160 compared to last year at about $168. So we're actually seeing a savings of about $8 per day per person. The same trend exists for medical expenses. Again, we're right around $125. And again, for the most part, this is hospital inpatient, outpatient services, and other diagnostic and treatment services. Overall, I think the bottom line is also an important figure. When Chloe was showing how our expenses are trending less than last year, this is a good illustration. At the end of November, we were spending $546 per person per month. Last year, we spent $558. So again, the things like the initiatives in the CCNC, the MC waivers, and those factors are showing up in our total expenses.
Excuse me, Mr. Owen. Yes. Chairman Dollar has a question he'd like to ask you.
Sure.
Steve, I apologize. Don't mean to interrupt your presentation, but I think it would be helpful, at least helpful to me, to just clarify for people the what might on the surface seem like a disconnect between the fact that we have we are under budget in terms of expenditures. We are seeing, as the slide shows here, the November per member per month being was it close to $12, $11 and some odd cents less than the 2012 versus when you see the trend line that was presented earlier saying, oh, well, you've got a 60-some million dollar short, which is actually fairly small compared to the program. Could you just harmonize what we're seeing, which would appear to be very good trends, and then what may be misinterpreted in terms of the line of the overall spend?
The weekly cash spending that we present every month, or we actually present it or prepare it once a week, was based on a distribution by week that we did about 6 months ago. And there are several assumptions that went into that, clearly enrollment, what we expected to happen around holidays, a variety of factors in terms of how we expected expenses to trend. So when you look at the cash, we're comparing against a weekly estimate we did about 6 months ago. When you look at these charts, what you're seeing is the actual expenditures per month. So what we're doing now to validate, because as I mentioned, when we do the annual forecast of expenditures, our annual forecast is showing our claims will come in about $5 million less than we expect, or as a surplus. We're actually going back and looking at our weekly spread to use everything we know today and redo it as if we were doing it 6 months ago, just to make sure that that trend line does actually move our weekly spread. So I think what you're looking at, the $52 million is a comparison to an estimate we did 6 months ago. This is the actual numbers that we're actually expending, if that answers your question.
So what you're saying is our actual number, we are under budget in terms of what we're spending, and we're spending less per person in Medicaid.
By the end of the year, we project right now we will be spending less per person than we budgeted to spend.
And we're spending less on this chart right now.
We're spending less each month right now.
Thank you.
CC&C obviously was a significant factor for us this year. I believe we had $149 million of state savings built into the budget. In terms of context, this is, again, the last or 4 years of the most recent report, actuarial report that was used to compile or identify the savings in the various categories of enrollment that we have in terms of total savings. Now, these are total dollars, and these are dollars net of the PMPMs that we pay to CC&C for care management. So that 149 that's in our state budget actually is about $426 million of total spendings or total requirements. Each month, I think the basic initiatives that were included in the $149 million were, again, increasing our age-blind and disabled enrollment. We also were expecting savings for the fact that our non-age-blind and disabled population was becoming more enrolled in CC&C. And then there were six different initiatives, like the enhanced plan, high-cost, high-risk patients, that we were expecting these initiatives to generate savings. We've actually are making progress toward our age-blind and disabled enrollment. We're still about 4.6% less than we had our 75% target. But as you'll see in a minute, we're actually, even with that, because of some of the other initiatives, we're making progress toward our total. At the end of November, for the first 5 months of this year, our savings target is about $2.8 million less than we had budgeted. I think last month we were at 4.9, so we've actually we've cut that in half this month in terms of progress toward achieving the getting back on track for on a monthly basis for being on track with our savings. The areas where we continue to work in terms of or identify variance in terms of the savings are in the age-blind and disabled population, primarily in utilization of emergency services and drugs, which, again, account for about $3.2 million difference when you look at overall savings of where we expect it to be. We've been working with CC&C. We've also had one meeting as well with the Hospital Association to really try to look at what are the opportunities, make sure we understand the trends, get ourselves together, and look at opportunities to bring those numbers back in line. Again, each month we go through a reforecasting. In the month of November, we actually used an update from our SAS model. Our SAS model helps us forecast enrollment. It uses a variety of socioeconomic factors or causal variables that we purchase from Global Insights to actually go through a statistical forecast for every network and every program aid category within each network. We build off of our PMPM expenditures. We make certain adjustments. And in this month's annual forecast, we've also put in the impact of all the delays in the MCO implementations that I think Kelly's going to talk about later. But we've got basically this is up to date now for everything that we know in terms of where we think the MCOs will be in terms of implementation. Again, overall right now, we expect by the end of the year that our four claims forecast will be about $5 million under appropriations, as you can see, less than 0.2% variance. For all funds right now, when we add in the $5 million surplus and the other funds, and again, the one thing that really changed this from this month from last month was our expectations around program integrity. We're looking at right now about a $12 million shortfall in terms of total expenses from Medicaid. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Owen. Are there questions from members of the committee for Mr. Owen? Senator Heiss.
The first question I kind of want to dive into, I've asked before, particularly about conditional spending that exists in this budget, that we're waiting on a determination to determine if that's funded or not. And the cutoff date for that is the funding that is available as of January 1st in a Medicaid funding. Do you have an indication yet from OSBM whether that those appropriations will be approved? And if not, do you suspect that from the information you've given us now on your budget through January that they will be able to certify in a month that you are on balance and have significant revenues in Medicaid to support that funding?
We have not received an indication from OSBM whether they will certify that. We're providing them the same information in terms of our annual forecast. One of the reasons obviously, I want to make sure, but I'm also going back to do a redistribution of our weekly spread is to really validate those annual assumptions. At this point, like I say, I've not received any indication either way from OSBM.
Senator Heiss, someone from OSBM is in the audience. If you would like to direct your question to Ms. Kilpatrick, she might be able to answer.
I would love to have that opportunity.
Yes, sir. Pam Kilpatrick. State Budget Office. The state, as the Medicaid agency has reported here today, the Medicaid budget is actually reporting a net shortfall, Steve, if I'm correct, of $12 million based on the current estimates through the end of the state fiscal year. So the determination about releasing the contingent appropriations, we have not released those appropriations. They are withheld from the allotments to the receiving state agencies, and that would be the Division of Mental Health for expansion of patient beds at Broughton Hospital, the three-way contract money, a literacy program within DCDEE, and then the final piece, which is the community, local and community wellness initiatives. So it's our understanding that the $20.9 million is meant to be held in the event that it's needed to address a Medicaid shortfall. And at this point, the agency is actually reporting a Medicaid shortfall. So those funds are still being withheld from the allotment of the other agencies.
Thank you very much for that question.
Thank you, Ms. Kilpatrick. Go ahead, Senator Heiss.
One other question I have, and this will be back to the agency. Thank you for your report on it. Also hearing with designations that are coming for institutes of mental disease, that in that appeal process, those institutions are not eligible to receive federal matching funds, but now the state is being required to continue maintenance of service as we move forward with full state dollars while they go through an appeal process. I think right now we're looking at five of those institutions, but are hearing that that number could quickly approach as many as, say, 40 of those institutions we could be looking at. Is there an indication in your budget to handle that additional state cost?
Right now I do have – we're tracking those expenditures right now. That is built into my base. I think Tara wanted to add something to that.
Mr. Heiss, Tara Larson with DMA. There are four homes right now that are due to the preliminary injunction. No other homes have been identified at this point. They're still going through the process. So if it was not for the preliminary injunction, then we would not have to pay for those state through state appropriations.
And just kind of a final wrap-up of trying to put these – we are looking at a point 5 months in that your expenditures are above budget and, as a matter of fact, much closer to last year's expenditures than to the current budget. If we continued on a trend of last year's expenditures, looking at the two budget, that's a shortfall of $300 million. When I come at this from a perspective of, I saw at the end of our budget last time nearly $140 million hole appear overnight in kind of giving this. What type of security should we put as we begin a budget process right now that at the end of the year that we are going to complete this in the financial positives as indicated on your statement?
In terms of the way the Medicaid expenditures, if you're looking at this year compared to last year, again, as the MCOs are implemented, those, again, the first 2 to 3 months, what you have are claims lags, so you basically are double paying. So in our first, if you will, first 5 months, what we've got, we really haven't seen the impact. So a lot of the impact of the, it ends up right now about $44 million, $45 million will occur in the second half of the year in terms of savings from the MCOs. CC&C is not nearly, although there is, the way their budget is spread, there is some ramping up of that, but not nearly that much. I want to say it's probably like $10 to $12 million difference by the end of the year. We think those two things. Now, the spread we've got here does assume that we handle rebates the same way we did last year, which was, that's one of the factors in here.
Chairman Dollar?
So the anticipation in terms of the actual medical side of Medicaid is that the utilization, the per member per month, right now anyway, is actually down. And you're anticipating in that program itself, you know, I mean, a $5 million surplus, I mean, basically it's level, essentially. So, you know, overall in Medicaid, are you essentially assuming that it meets forecast, that it's level with the total expenditures from last year, or will it be under or over the total expenditures from last year, actual spending for Medicaid? And I realize that you've got a part of a variance here is anticipated savings in the program integrity area, which we may or may not receive. It looks like right now we're not getting as much savings in that arena or as much revenue in that arena, depending on your perspective, as we were hoping for. But in terms of the actual spend of the program for services, could you comment on that?
My expectation right now in terms of services claims payments, that we'll see both our PMPM and our total expenditures less this year than last year, again, primarily as a result of the fact that our enrollment is tracking less than we expected, although we do have some variance in mix. But as we see these programs come into full being, we'll see those impact on further reducing our PMPM costs. The program integrity right now, what we're running into is appeals, and we're not seeing those yield right now the level of savings or level of revenue, if you will, that we expected.
So the is part of that the delay with OAH as well as outcomes from OAH?
It's a combination. I mean, that would be part of the factor.
And Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up with a little different line of question. I recall there was additional money put into the budget last year over and above the number required for rebasing the program. So are all those funds factored into this, or do we have pots of money that are sitting out there that are not being factored in at this point?
We're presenting all money, so this has put the rebase plus all the funds that were put in, either put in or taken out of the budget. So this has got everything in the budget in here.
And just one final question. In terms of our overall claims paid end of the year once things are reconciled, could you comment on what does Medicaid look like end of the fiscal year 10, end of the fiscal year 9, end of the fiscal year 10, end of the fiscal year 11 for total claims paid in Medicaid? What are the trends we've seen in the last couple of years in terms of our overall claims paid spent?
I can give you a general. I don't really have the numbers off the top of my head.
That's fine.
I think generally what we were seeing, particularly in 9 and 10, we were seeing variations in enrollment. We were seeing enrollment higher, plus we were seeing mix. We also saw consumption growing at a much faster rate. Again, consumption for us measures the proportion of the population that's actually utilizing services. And so from a total spending perspective, we had not appropriation, but total requirements. What we saw is, I believe, total requirements were higher than what we had actually budgeted. We also had ARRA funds coming in and out during that time. I'd be happy to get you the detailed information on that for the prior years. Thank you.
Senator Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Owen, on follow-up to Senator Heiss's question, I didn't hear the answer I was looking for. What do you project our budget shortfall in Medicaid is going to be this year as we try to budget and plan?
The total shortfall for claims, settlements, basically all funds within Medicaid, right now we're projecting a $12 million shortfall.
And moving forward in 13, what do we think we're going to? I guess my question, oversimplified, is you know, we had to come up with what, $205 million last short session. Do you perceive that there have been corrections made within your department and the budgeting process? The fact that we're not going to have that big smoking gun during session or either in the following short session?
If we go back to 2012, some of the things that were going on then is I remember we had a $90 million reduction item in there for CC&C. We actually achieved somewhere around the $30 million range. So that was a large piece of it. And so there, I believe the rebase process and the budget process this year provided a much more realistic expectation of what we should be spending.
And that expectation is what? I mean, I know you can't. What I'm looking for is give me your conservative hole that you think we're going to be in through this process, or as Senator Heiss used the word, positive in the black. What are we facing in just looking into the crystal ball? I'm just trying to help understand what we're looking at.
We've done again, the forecast that we typically do right now, you know, I'm showing a $12 million shortfall. We are looking at some basically ranges of that. I think Fiscal Research has asked us to prepare a forecast, assuming, because the way SAS gives us a range of enrollment. That forecast with that other range, with the high end range of enrollment, I believe would add about $18 million to that shortfall. If enrollment were at the high end.
One more question. How do we make up the overzealous budget projections for CC&C? You got a $60 million shortfall. Where is that going to? I mean, you guys didn't do that. We did that in our budget. You may have told us it wasn't going to be that high. There were members here, Dr. Purcell and a number of others, that didn't think that we were going to achieve that $90 million. Senator Mansfield talked about the fact that couldn't achieve that and we didn't achieve that. Where do you make up that $60 million?
Again, this year's budget assumed $149 million. Right now, through the first 5 months, we're $2.6 million short of that number. The number from last year, again, because when we went through and did the rebase, in effect, that, if you will, shortfall was built into the rebase. So we start off with that base there, from the base of where we actually spent last year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Dollar.
Yeah, I want to comment. I want to make sure it's clarified on, because we covered this ground before, but on part of our problem with regard to CCNC this time last year, if you go back to a year ago when we were here, The challenge was that we were not getting the percentage of ABD people signed up that we had projected to get signed up to achieve the savings. Now, there's differences of opinion, and I'm not going to, you know, do a back and forth with a department. I'm going to save them that. But there were those of us that viewed that CCNC and were under the operation, under the understanding CCNC could sign those people up. The department took a different view of that. And it wasn't until, I guess, in the February-March time frame that the department had moved to get PCG, as I recall, up and running to help us get caught up as a state with the percentage that we wanted to reach in ABD enrollment. And so I just want to be very clear about this, that that was not CCNC's fault, okay? We didn't get, you know, those folks signed up as soon as we were projecting to wanting to get them signed up. But to the extent that they are signed up and to the extent that we can get that move, that percentage moving up towards 75% and hopefully at some point in time more than that, that is really key. I mean, I think what has to be kept in mind for us as policymakers is that the age, blind, and disabled population, which is a big, expensive population, we have to get those people in under care management. And we're never going to have a hope at controlling utilization with these folks and controlling their health care costs or helping better manage their health care costs until we get them into a medical home. And so I think sometimes that's that kind of gets lost in the numbers. But I think, as you said, Mr. Owen, right now the projection is we're within 0.2% on Medicaid.
Correct.
Wouldn't you say that's pretty phenomenal to be that close to being on track with an entitlement program? That's, what, $12 billion?
We feel pretty good with the number right now.
Further questions from members of the committee? Representative Murray, I'm sorry.
Yes, I was wondering if the department might be able to elaborate on the 2 to 3 other options that are viable options that the governor was mentioning regarding the group home issue that we're all facing at the end of the year.
If there's someone who could answer that.
I think that we're out exploring all the options. So at this point, we don't have a response for that.
Any further questions? Seeing none, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Burr, Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to point out, going back to the discussion about the what Senator Heiss said and others, and Representative Dollars, Chairman Dollars' comment about are you using all the dollars you have available. I know there were an additional $100 million put into the savings reserve for Medicaid that the General Assembly did last year, and I don't believe that's part of what you're calculating in. So there is an additional $100 million sitting there available for the department at if needed.
That's correct.
Further questions from members of the committee? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Owen and Ms. Larson, for the presentation. Next item on the agenda is a status report on MMIS. Mr. Paul Guthrie is recognized to present his briefing.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here today. As indicated, I'm here to give a status report on the MMIS effort. If I can figure out how to run the... Okay. First slide is a slide we've seen before that represents the schedule. The dotted line is where we are right now. We haven't moved any of these schedule bars since we rebaselined the schedule as part of Contract Amendment 2 back in 2011. Current status, we're on schedule for July 1, 2013 operational start. User acceptance testing is in progress, scheduled to complete on January 16th. As part of user acceptance testing, we're working with selected members of the provider community and letting them exercise the system with us. Production simulation testing is in progress by our vendor, CSC, scheduled to complete on January 16th. We're dealing with changes that were formalized after the system freeze went into effect. Development's underway, and we're planning for additional testing to be completed before operational start. We're also continuing the design of the eligibility interface. NCFAST and the MMIS are on different timetables. Temporary interface is going to be required until NCFAST is completely rolled out. User acceptance testing begin as scheduled August 29th. We'll complete on January 16th. It's state testing of the complete system. Individual portions of system functionality are looked at in detail. End-to-end business functionality is tested, and we also work with our providers on some test activities. UAT for providers. It's an opportunity for selected providers to use the new system. They started coming in to Raleigh to be with us on November 13th, and the last one leaves on January 11th. We're divided these providers up into groups of similar interest. Each is in Raleigh for 2, 3, or 4 days, depending on the complexity of the parts of the system they're working with. Activities include training, working with the provider portal, seeing how claims adjudicate. To get these providers, we worked with 23 of the provider associations, solicited nominees. 37 providers were nominated by 8 associations. And the 6 different, each of these groups has 1 week of the UAT for providers for their experience in Raleigh with us. Very positive feedback so far from the providers that have been participating. And this is really good to hear. As you know, we've been working on this system for a while, and it's good to have somebody come in from outside and that appreciates what the end product looks like. And you can just see some summarizations of the comments that we've gotten from the provider associate or from the providers that have participated with us. The dental group started us out. Then we had some public health providers. Last week was 4 professional providers. This week we have nursing homes and home and hospice are in Raleigh with us. Spoke with them earlier today. Excuse me. Production simulation testing is underway also. This is where CSC works with the system to make sure that the system response time is appropriate, that a batch cycle at night can be completed in one night, that the number of claims that need to be processed overnight can be handled. And one of the more interesting parts of this is a comparative testing, actually starting with 5,000 claims that have already processed through the legacy solution and running those through the new solution and doing an electronic comparison on the results. So the 5,000 was like a practice run, so to speak. When we finish later this month or in early January, they will have done this comparison on 1.2 million claims in one batch. So that's basically a check write worth of claims. So that's pointing out some defects that we have in the in claims process and allow those to be fixed prior to go live. And again, some of these differences may be okay. That the goal of the system's to pay to policy, not to pay like the other systems pay in. But this is a good good benchmark for us. Production simulation testing scheduled to complete on January 16th. Legacy system synchronization. Our plan was to incorporate all applicable changes to the replacement MMIS that have been made to the legacy system since the requirements were defined for the new system. Modifications, in reality, the modifications to the legacy solution have continued after the system freeze date due to mission-critical Medicaid changes. A little history to put things in perspective. Since the legacy system was put into operation, there have been over 15,000 changes made to that system, with 2,043 of them have occurred since the replacement MMIS RFP was released in July of 2007. There are practical limitations to the level of change that can be made to the system once we started final testing. We started the final UAT in August. System soft freeze began on March 2nd, and the hard freeze on May 31st. We started testing on August 29th for user acceptance testing. The changes that were approved after the freeze date are not available in our current user acceptance testing environment. So to start solving that, we allocated, worked with the vendor CSC to allocate additional capacity for change. We are working with them and talking about moving the operational readiness date from March 1st, 2013 to July 1, 2013. We will maintain a July 1, 2013 operational start. Now, if you remember that the operational readiness date was not something that was in the original contract, that was something that we put in place when we introduced the provider operational preparedness period. And in some ways, it was a reserve. With the additional changes we've had, we feel like it's appropriate to move that readiness date now to July 1 to accommodate these additional critical changes. In addition to get this level of change in, we are using capacity that was originally allocated to the ICD-10 effort, which is a federally mandated code change. The federal agencies have moved the compliance date from October 1st, 2013 to October 1st, 2014. Work is continuing on ICD-10 in preparation for the system change, but we've backed off on the actual implementation of those changes with CSC to allow that capacity to be used to implement these mission-critical changes. We do anticipate an additional final integration and user acceptance testing period in the April-May 2013 timeframe. These activities will be overlapped with the provider operational preparedness. There are additional CSRs that are still in the backlog that will not be addressed by operational start. Post-operational start software releases are anticipated on October 1st, 2013 and January 1st, 2014, working with the agency to get manual workarounds in place where appropriate. It's important to remember that these MMIS systems are under constant revision. The legacy MMIS currently has 122 revisions outstanding. There's one legacy system change 13568, which I believe implemented some monitoring for a number of recipient visits mandated by the legislature. It's currently under development. It's been outstanding since May 7, 2009, so it's been in the works for over 3 years. A lot of these changes are not implemented quickly. Okay, moving on to transition planning. We talked about last on my last visit the strategy for transition of physical agent services, including operations, the system, and data functions to be transitioned from HP and DHHS to CSC. Deployment planning is underway. Then there's also a DHHS business function transition to help the staff start using the new system to perform business functions. Organizational change management is underway. First session's planned for this month. Our approach to the deployment planning, the initial framework from CSC for the planning document has been delivered at the end of November. And essentially, these additional iterations provide more and more levels of detail to the plan. So we'll start working with the legacy vendors on the deployment plan as part of iteration 2, which is scheduled for delivery at the end of January of 2013. More details from those discussions are available in the March 31, 2013 iteration of that plan. The final iteration of the plan gives a detailed rollout and deployment along with the back-out plan and actually completes the plan. Okay, moving on to the to our costs, actual costs to date, and these are broken down for between OMAS and the divisions. You can see their total to date is $160,881,300. Projected total costs for the replacement project of $248,228,749. That's through the development phases and deployment. Operations and maintenance costs, there's $189,614,000. And a good comparative number to that is found on the last slide, which is if we had extended the operation of our legacy solutions, that total cost would have been $377,407,708. So those are the comparative numbers. That's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Guthrie. Are there questions from members? Doctor, please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This process has taken many years and cost a lot of money, and I wonder if Mr. Guthrie would, in layman's terms, just tell us what we'll have when we get through, who will have access to this, and in general, how this improves the operation of this area of state government.
Absolutely. As we talked about having the providers in working with us, they're all just love the provider portal functionality that we have demonstrated. They can log into the system using the internet from their offices to a website and pull up and see their claims out there, what the status of the claims are. They can inquire on recipient eligibility. One thing that some of them are just real interested in, they can load up a file that has a week's worth of recipients in it, send it to us, and we'll send back the eligibility information there. Whereas in the past, they were having to make calls to an AVRS system and do it one at a time. So they're very excited about doing that. Recipients will also have access to the system over the internet to be able to check on their eligibility, the so I think those are two groups that will have direct access to the system that have not had it before. We feel like we're putting in a, you know, claims processing engine that's based on business rules, the edits and the audits. We feel like that's providing more capability for change going forward. We're putting in a platform that is a multi-payer platform. If I'm not sure what North Carolina is going to choose to do with the Affordable Care Act, but if we had to handle new eligibles, this is a flexible platform that would allow us to be able to do that.
Further questions, Dr. Purcell? Senator Tucker.
Mr. Guthrie, thank you for this presentation. I still see you're on track for your July 1 startup date.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Okay. Where in this presentation, well, let me back up, maybe give me a better idea, and you may not be able to answer it, but some of your colleagues might. What was the original intended cost of this project to begin with, and what's it going to cost when we go live July 1? What will it have cost?
I'm going to defer. Ed Riley's our contracts manager. I'm going to defer that to Ed.
Mr. Riley, go ahead, sir.
Yes, the original amount was about half of what we expected today for the development cost. Today, if you flip back to the previous slide, we're anticipating $196 million for the development phase of this project. Originally, it was about $92 million, or just under $100 million.
Just one other question, too. If I remember, I saw in some sheets somewhere where we were supposed to have an anticipated savings of $3 million a month. Is that correct? And is that in these numbers? I don't see that anywhere in this.
I don't think it's quite $3 million, but it should be shortly, just slightly under $3 million, over $2.5 million savings per month in operation expenses, yes.
And once the system's up and running, there's a way that you can verify that we did, in fact, receive those savings and there is a payback?
Not exactly, because the systems we retire, we won't be getting invoices from those vendors, so we can't compare our actuals to anybody else's actuals. All we can do is compare what our actual invoices will be to what we projected the other vendors would have invoiced us.
Just one more follow-up, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go ahead, sir.
Well, how did someone come up with $3 million as a projected savings in all the information that we had received? How did they come up with that projection? And then after startup, you're not going to be able to project what we save. I mean, help me with that.
We can project what we save. We just can't verify that what the vendor, the systems that are going to be retired, we can't guarantee what they would have invoiced. We can only project, and in our projections, we're anticipating a 3% growth each year. We don't know for sure if those vendors would have charged that amount more or less, but there are probably four or five contracts that will be retired once this system is implemented.
Well, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Guthrie, on page 5 of your handouts, you say at the bottom of one sheet, you say that or mention that there's 37 providers nominated by 8 associations.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and then also you worked with 23 provider associations. Could I get, just for my own information, I don't know if others in the committee are interested, but I'd like to have information or further information on it if I could.
Would you like a list of providers?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, sir. We can provide that.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Senator Heiss next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at and the slide that's up there now is is any, when you're saying we need to compare for projections beginning 13-14, that would look to me that you're indicating an assumption that the legacy system will no longer be charging or billing to the state in the contract beginning July 1st, 2013, if that's the numbers we already use comparison. Is that the date you anticipate ending your contract with HP moving forward, or how long are you anticipating? If not, we'll be paying for two systems in operations.
July 1 is the date we're going live with the replacement solution. And I believe the contracts are scheduled to end with the legacy vendors on that same, on July 1.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. Who is actually doing the testing with the vendors now?
We have several different tracks going on with that. The first one is there's the OMAS team is doing user acceptance testing. For each of the software builds, we have the people that worked on the design validating that the system implemented the design that they had envisioned. In addition, we have other staff from OMAS that are doing end-to-end business function testing, where they're taking business scenarios and going from one end to the other end. We've also worked with our divisions, DMA, DMH, DDSAS, and DPH, and they have staff that are working with us on testing from the division perspective. Now, we have a lot of division people from a lot of the OMA staff used to be division people, but these are people that have been working with the division lately that hadn't been so intimately involved in the design, so it gives another perspective to it. And then the last group is the providers that are coming in with us working on the UAT for providers sessions.
Follow up on that, please. All these experts and what they're doing, we won't have a mess like we've had.
That's certainly our goal, not to have a mess. These people are very qualified. The OMAS team has been in place for a number of years. It's been one of the best groups I've ever worked with as far as knowing what their business is. We have people on the OMAS staff that have worked with DSS, with DMA, with the various agencies. So this wasn't a bunch of outsiders that came in to specify these things. I feel like we have a very qualified team in place.
Okay, my last question. Under the contract, should once this goes up and goes live and it just something happens, who is responsible for that? Are we going to be having to pay? Or
I'm going to let my friend in contracts answer that question.
That would totally depend on who's responsible for whatever went wrong. We have over 200 service level agreements with the vendor, and if they're in violation of an SLA, they would be responsible to recoup any of the costs it would take to get back to where we need it to be.
That causes me to ask another question. So who would pay for it right then and you recoup your money? I mean, we shouldn't be having to pay, right? You would be covering that.
Well, I guess it would depend if the cost, it was a payment to a provider and it went out by mistake. Yes, we'd have to recoup that from the vendor right away. If it was an administrative cost, we would probably work through the details and determine who was responsible for that administrative additional cost and either charge the vendor or the state would have to pay it if the state was responsible for the mistake.
Further questions from members of the committee? Senator Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thinking about looking at the date of July 2013, July 1, and so hopefully the Mayans aren't correct about their date either. What's the contingency plan if it's not up and running by the 13th?
If we don't have the system available on the 13th, we would have to continue with our legacy vendor.
A follow-up. If we talk to the vendor about, because if the contract's supposed to end on that date, what do we do?
I don't have that contract. I'm not know the intimate details of that contract. I know there's some there's a series of dates that we have to work with them on notifications. So I think as we move through time, we'll be making staying in contact with them, letting them know if we're foreseeing any difficulties on making that date. Everything that we're seeing right now, though, indicates that the system is in good shape, the quality's there, and that we will make the date.
Follow-up.
Go ahead, sir.
Also, in your slide, you had a changes that are coming down the pipe in the fall of 13, in the spring, I believe, of 14. Can you get a list of those changes and what those changes are and how much they'll cost, if they'll cost additional funds to the state?
Okay, we can provide a list of what the backlog is. Those have not all been costed at this point, but we do have a change budget allocated, and we do not anticipate that these changes will exceed the amount in our change budget.
For the changes in 13 and 14?
Yes. Okay. For the life of the contract, there's changes budgeted for the life of the contract.
Follow up with the changes that we had before on the previous system. Can we get a list of all those changes that you listed up there?
I believe we can get that for you.
And just one follow-up, one final question, Mr. Chairman. Looking at all the employees that are working on from the HHS on the state side are working for the switchover, how many of those that you anticipate will be a reduction in staff when the system switched over?
As far as on the state side?
Right.
I don't have that number. I'm not sure if...
No, I do not, but I anticipate they'll just redirect their staff to other activities.
So there are a number of staff that are in the OMAS office right now that are scheduled to revert back to their original positions at the division before the program started. There's also a number of staff that are contractors right now that will be released after the system's implemented. There is another consideration that certification will probably come 12 months after July 1, 2013 from CMS. And we'll keep some staff in place to make sure that the system does get certified. That has a large financial impact with our federal partners.
Just to follow up on the contractor part, of those contractors, do you see if any of those coming out onto the state or any state people, state employees currently going on to contracts?
Okay, contractors coming with the state, I'd highly recommend my whole team because, they know how the system works. They know a lot about the details of how the Medicaid program works. I don't have a plan. I hadn't seen a plan on that or hadn't developed a plan on that. Another initiative that will be continuing until 2014 is the ICD-10 effort, though, and there will be staff in place to be able to do that effort as well.
Thank you.
Are there further questions from members of the group? Yes, sir. Do you have another comment?
Yes, a clarifying comment regarding the savings. When they asked, at one time it was over $3 million a month. That was correct when we started the project, but that included a large savings when Blue Cross Blue Shield was executing the health choice claims. Since that time, about a year ago, HP took over the processing of health choice claims at a much lower rate than Blue Cross Blue Shield was processing them. So when we retired the HP system, our savings dropped from over $3 million to just under $3 million a month. But at one time, it was in excess of $3 million.
Any further questions from members? If not, Mr. Guthrie, thank you very much for your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, just an insight from Mr. Guthrie.
He's not sitting down.
Yes, sir. And he doesn't need to on this one. Just when you do the startup, I just want you to know I'm buying the champagne bottle to break.
Thank you very much. Be ready on July 1, 2013.
All right, sir. I'll be there. You call me.
We'll plan on that. Next on the agenda, Ms. Kelly Crosby to make a presentation on the 1915 BC waiver update. Ms. Crosby is Chief Behavioral Health Section and DMA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm here today to give the monthly update on the 1915 BC waiver expansion. We do have an update from last month, of the number of counties that are now under the BC waiver. Sand Hills Center started operations on December 1st, so now we have 65 counties under the BC waiver. Last month, we reported that Mercer was finishing their 60-day readiness reviews of the other LMEs that had not gone live yet. And Mercer has finalized the reports on Partners, Alliance, Center Point, and East Point. You will see there the dates that Mercer has recommended that those LMEs be able to go live under the BC waiver. East Point, it is recommended that they continue with their January 1st start date, but Mercer did recommend that the other three LMEs, Partners, Alliance, and Center Point, start operations on February 1st, 2013. We are still waiting for the draft reports from MechLink and Coastal Care, although Mercer did give us a long list of that would be the areas of their concern and areas that would need further development, so that MechLink and Coastal Care would have time to work on those issues before their final readiness review, which will happen next week. On as a reminder, this is the same update that we give every month. The Secretary has issued a final start date of February 1st, 2013 for all of the LMEs. If any LME is not prepared for the February 1st start date, the department will transition the MCO functions to another LME MCO that is able to operate. And as a reminder, the department and Mercer have studied and identified several contingency plans for any LME area that is not prepared to go live February 1st. We were asked to give an update on the financial impact of the delays. And these are the MCOs that were expected to go live in January and have been pushed back until February. As you can see, the total for all of the LMEs is $3 million. Steve is not here to give any additional information on that, but I think that Ms. Larson can answer questions if any come up on that. This is the updated map.
Ms. Crosby, excuse me. Chairman Dollar would like to ask a question.
So those figures right there represent the one month delay, basically from January 1 to February 1, and the impact of that 1 month delay. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
And please go ahead, Ms. Crosby.
Thank you. This is the updated map that does show the LMEs with start dates in January and February. As a reminder, Guilford County will go live with Sand Hills in April. That was already discussed and finalized several months ago. This is the most updated map. And finally, I'll give you another update on Innovations Plus. As you recall, under session law last year, we were to design the Innovations waiver and look at aggregate funding. We were to use a system of allocation of resources based on a reliable assessment of need for individuals on that C waiver. And we have chosen the supports intensity scale, which I have described in the past. The supports intensity scale assessments are ongoing currently. We have completed over 850 assessments, and each LME MCO has had 2 to 3 community trainings and stakeholder groups on the CIS assessment specifically. And results from the CIS assessments as they are being completed are being used for individual service planning. Phase 2 of Innovations Plus was to use those scores and the aggregate level to develop a resource allocation model for individuals on the waiver. As mentioned in previous months, HSRI will take results from a representative sample of those assessments, around 5,200, that is about half of our population, to develop a resource allocation model. They anticipate developing the resource bands in the summer of 2013 and beginning implementation of those resource allocation bands in the fall of 2013. This is new information. Over the past several weeks, HSRI and members from the department have traveled to each MCO to engage with those stakeholder groups that were already developed around the CIS assessment to provide additional information on resource allocation as it develops, to get local input and to maintain active stakeholder work groups at the local level. As mentioned before, those stakeholder groups will be maintained as more assessments take place, as individuals are using the results of those assessments to plan for their services, and as the resource allocation model is developed. And I'd be happy to take questions on any of this.
Are there any questions of Ms. Crosby from members of the committee? Senator Heiss.
Just real quickly, on one of your slides, you had put it that if an MCO was not prepared on February 1st, to make that you could transition that to their services to another MCO. And my interest is probably not whether somebody meets that deadline, but that general process of transitioning to another MCO. Is that a process that, I mean, by the time you would look at going into a new region, establishing new contracts, I mean, isn't that ultimately going to be a multi-month minimum process to try to transition? I mean, most of them, it's taking 6 months. It wouldn't be that much faster to pick up a new region or territory, would it?
No. To try to do it right and well in order to transition providers, transition consumers, it would definitely take, I would say, a minimum of 90 days, maybe 120 days to do it thoughtfully and correctly. But, you know, we'd try for 90 days.
If I may add, Senator Heiss, one of our contingencies is we are continuing to look across the board on capacity already, so that the MCOs who are in operation or who will be in operation, if need be, we will know and they will know capacity and what resources they may need if they had to assume other counties. So we are not waiting until those last minute decisions to actually move forward. So there are plans, and the existing MCOs are part of that process.
And just real quickly on that, is this I know that this was kind of put out for those who could not read a deadline of February. Would this be a similar procedure the department would look at if an MCO were to not be financially sustainable long term, or not be able to provide services, or was going to collapse in this procedure?
Yes, sir.
Let the record reflect that Ms. Tara Larson contributed to those answers as well. Senator Tucker?
Well, perhaps she can answer some of these then. Can you go back to your group of MCOs that are on hold up there? I guess MechLink is Mecklenburg County?
Yes, sir.
And they're going to be ready to, well, let me back up. That February 1st, 2013, to transition MCOs that are not ready to go to other MCOs, is that in statute that the secretary has to make that decision?
The statute says that the secretary has to make the decision by December 31st.
Okay. You know, I've been involved in this a long time, it seems like. All these... Tell me what you guys know. We're supposed to have, and Chairman Dollar can correct me if I'm wrong, $52 million in savings. Is that the number I remember in the 2013 budget? And Ms. Larson's nodding her head. How close will we come to achieving or not achieving that? And how in the world is MechLink, who just really transitioned to get on board with this, under direction of the county, how are they going to be ready? Did I see what, February 1st? Is that what I see? Or, yeah.
I think to your first question, I think it would be important to have Steve Owen give you the entire budget with the delays, you know, to put against the $52 million that was in the budget. All I have on the slide is what 1 month delay, what the cost of 1 month delay is. To speak to your second point, what we do rely upon is the readiness reviews from Mercer, having specific benchmarks for MechLink or any other MCO, and Mercer telling us how soon and when they can be ready. So I'm trying to answer your question with facts about what our consultant tells us needs to be ready and where they are in that readiness process, and not just try to look at those facts as opposed to when folks geared up and when they didn't.
Ms. Chair, just one more question. So you're going to have Mr. Owen get back to me and tell me that we are or are not going to hit that $52 million in savings? And number one, and then number two, who would take over MechLink if they're not ready to go February 1st?
Senator Tucker, just one second. Mr. Owen is not here now. We have some figures that he apparently has delivered to us, but we want to double-check those before we disseminate that to the members of the committee. Would that be? Chairman? Okay. Any further? Did you have another question that you wanted to ask?
I think Ms. Larson maybe didn't want to answer this question, but who will absorb MechLink, which is a huge organization, as another MCO if they're not ready to come online with the timeline that's been projected?
That's one of the reasons both MechLink and Coastal Care are having an additional review in December. There were some concerns on their readiness, their initial readiness review, and so they were reviewed in November. They're having another review in December. That we are looking at capacity of the existing MCOs to be prepared to take MechLink or Coastal Care or any other situations that may be beyond that February 1 date. But as Mr. Owen has, I think, shared with the committee, he is factoring in some of those issues with that rebase and those numbers that he is going to share with you. So at this point, I'm not avoiding your question. I'm just saying that we're looking at capacity of the existing MCOs to be able to assume, if they need to, Mecklenburg and Coastal Care. Or Coastal Care.
Ms. Chair, just one more question, and that's a fair response to that question. I thank you for that. What I remember about June 30th, there was a six-month window in there that everybody didn't have to go live June 30th. Is that still being exercised, or are we trying to hold people's feet to the fire and let's get ready and go, which I'm okay with if that's the case?
Actually, the original plan was January 1, and then June 30th was that six-month window. However, the legislation did have that we needed to have the decision made of who was ready to go live. So that's where that December 31st date came in.
Thank you, ma'am.
Further questions from members of the committee? Hearing none, thank you very much. Ms. Crosby, for your presentation, and Ms. Larson for assisting. Next item on the agenda, I just want to remind everyone that those agencies that are required to submit mandatory reports to the Legislative Oversight Committee on Health and Human Services, those reports and reporting requirements are listed on the committee website. You may find them there. Our next meeting is going to be January 8th at 2 p.m. That's 2 p.m. on January 8th. That'll be the next and probably final committee meeting. Well, maybe, I don't know if we have a second one or not. That's the final. I think that will be our final Legislative Oversight Committee. The end is in sight. One thing, I'm going to take just a second to advise you that a document inadvertently ended up in our distribution package this morning that was not authorized by any chair to be there, and so you may just disregard that. There being no further business to come before our committee today, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.